Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The civil rights movement of the mid-20th century was propelled by the work of determined and vigilant activists. The efforts of people like Rosa Parks and Dr. Martin Luther King are cemented in history, and among the list of important leaders is Ella Baker. She grew up in rural Littleton, North Carolina. Her activism began as a student at Shaw University in Raleigh in the 1920s. She went on to work with the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And in 1960, she helped bring together student activists in the wake of the sit-ins at Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, just a block away. The meeting took place at Shaw University and birthed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC. A new book for young adults chronicles the work of Ella Baker. It's called We Who Believe in Freedom, The Life and Times of Ella Baker. And joining me now is Lee Williams. She wrote the book. She's a former administrator at Bennett College and North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro, and now teaches at Guilford Technical Community College. Lee, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you.
Start a little bit with Ella Baker's roots. Of course, born in Virginia, but really grew up in North Carolina. Tell us about growing up here.
Well, she moved back with her parents at the age of 7 from Norfolk, Virginia. They lived in Littleton, North Carolina. Ella Baker was always influenced by her family, by her Black Baptist roots, and by education, and you mentioned Shaw University. She started out as a very smart young woman. She was one of three children. Her mother and father both had roots in North Carolina, and in one generation, they moved from enslaved people who were their parents to moving up the educational ladder. And the parents insisted that Ella and her two siblings also got a quality education. So schooling was always very important for her. In fact, in that day and time, and Ella Baker was born in 1903, there were not many schools for African Americans then, so she and her siblings went to a private church-sponsored school. Before she went to Shaw Academy as a ninth grader, her mother kept her at home to study with a private tutor for a whole year. Writing was important, knowing how to write well, knowing how to speak well, and so those were the things that she focused on.
And that Shaw Academy, of course, associated with the university, but it was also a boarding school, so she had to leave home.
It was a boarding school at ninth, and she went for ninth grade. She matriculated through high school, and then through college, she got her undergraduate degree there. She was the valedictorian of her class. As I listen to people talking about UNCG and especially Woman's College, some of what Ella Baker experienced, you can imagine. There were stricter rules at Shaw Academy and the university.
She went to Shaw and butted heads there as well, right?
Yes, and when she went to the university, one of the first acts of rebellion there was when the president asked her to sing. It was not unusual, and this was a white president. Shaw did not have an African-American president until 1931. Oh. And Ella Baker graduated in 1927. Mm-hmm. So the president asked her if she would sing a Negro spiritual to one of the visiting dignitaries. People from the Northeast would come. These were potential contributors to the university. And she refused. She felt it was demeaning and that she did not want to sing spirituals, did not want to be exploited in that way. And then the final time that's recorded that she rebelled was when she was a senior, because taking a course in Bible study, the New Testament, Old Testament was part of the curriculum. There were students who felt that one professor was particularly unfair in that he did not allow the students to bring notes to class and other professors did. And so, again, they said, we don't think this is fair. We do not want to have to take this test in order to graduate. It was a graduation requirement. But they relented on that. I think some parents probably got in touch with them and said, look, you've spent time there. It's time to graduate. We do not want you to endanger that. So they went ahead and took the test, but they did protest against the one professor.
She then moves to he did allow, by the way, stone tablets, but just no. Forgive me, I'm sorry. She moves to Harlem now and, again, becomes very involved in the Harlem Renaissance and the arts and culture scene out there.
Well, you can imagine a young woman, although she was 23 years old, she had really been in this very cloistered community of Shaw Academy and Shaw University. She gets to Harlem in 1927, in the middle of the Harlem Renaissance. And it's so eye-popping what is going on there. And she took to it like a duck to water. Places, storied places like the YWCA in Harlem, the YMCA, the Harlem branch of the public library, which is now the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. These were havens for Ella Baker because she could meet other young people who were just as curious intellectually as she was. She came across people who were espousing what were radical political ideas, but they were thoughts that she had in her head that they articulated. And so she found a community in Harlem.
And organized, began really organizing people around first a cooperative and then getting young people together, right?
She did. One of the first jobs that she had was working at the Harlem Y. It was a youth program. And this was to be typical of Ella Baker throughout her career. Anything that she touched, she made better. And this was a youth program, which was kind of an idea that someone at the library had. They gave it to Ella Baker and told her to go forth with it. And what she was able to do was to make that into a star program at the library. She brought in people from the community who were prominent to talk to young people. She exposed them to books, literature, ideas. She also reached out to other people in other organizations and brought them in to the organization, collaborated with them. This, again, was sort of a signature way that Ella Baker found to build coalitions with other people.
This coalition building and grassroots sensibility that she had about organizing would essentially bring her to loggerheads when she was part of the NAACP and, again, the SCLC, right?
It did. It brought her to loggerheads with the established civil rights organizations. She went in, and like so many of the women in the movement, they were kind of silent voices in the community. They were behind-the-scenes people. The out front people were the men, and at the NAACP, that was the case, whether it was Walter White or Roy Wilkins at the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. These were people she often had a very tense relationship with because she spoke her mind.
And she ascended to leadership positions, even having a sort of temporary leadership of the SCLC after being associate director, and they never would appoint her the head of
the... They never did. First, she was asked to come in by two of Martin Luther King's male lieutenants to help draw up a blueprint for an organization. This was after the Montgomery bus boycott, and King wanted to know how can we keep this movement going and how can we seed it throughout and spread it throughout the South. And so the two men knew Ella Baker and knew the work that she had done at the NAACP. They said, we've got to have her on this team. Well, King was reluctant to have her, but finally he was persuaded to bring her in. So she worked to draw up the blueprint and then worked after the organization got started. She really worked at the office of the SCLC. They went out after a while, decided, well, we need a paid staff person to be the director. They went out seeking that person through a search. They never considered Baker for it. The first person who was director came, was there for about a year, did not work out very well. They had a second search. Again, they overlooked Baker. And when she got fed up with organizations, that's when she decided she would move on.
Well, talk about that. Sadly, we only have a couple of minutes left, but we do need to hear about her role founding SNCC.
Yes. Yeah. She was pleased in 1960 to read about four students who sat down at the Woolworth's lunch counter, and that movement spread throughout the South. She wanted to bring together the college student leaders. She thought that they needed to be organized. She wanted them to get to know one another. She thought they could learn. There were lessons to be learned. And so she did get the SCLC to give some money, $800, to convene a meeting in April of 1960 on the campus of Shaw University. And she brought together the leaders. Martin Luther King agreed to come and speak. The young people came, and the second meeting that they had was when SNCC was birthed.
And, of course, there's a big debate in the SCLC about whether or not even young people should be part of this movement, right? I mean, that was part of the resistance she faced.
Well, she faced that, but they also, because the sit-ins were so so well-received and had spread, so that they wanted those young people to become part of their organizations. But she said, form your own.
She went on, and I think the message in most of her, and I don't want to reduce it to this, but it was certainly about grassroots organizing, ground up, and that was really not the way things were going.
No, it was top down, very much top down, male dominated, and she would go into a community. She would look for the grassroots leaders. She would provide training through workshops for them. She went to places where the NAACP staff thought women would not go. It was not appropriate. It was not the proper place. It might have been a pool room, a barbershop, a beauty shop, a bar, a filling station. She recruited people who were respected in the community and taught them how to be leaders.
You have written this book for a younger audience. Tell me why you think it's so important that that younger folks know
about
it.
Well, this came out of a first book that was Servants of the People, the 1960s Legacy of African American Leadership. The second edition in 2009 included Ella Baker, and I just felt that I wanted a younger audience of a new generation of young people to know about leaders and to know about leaders like Ella Baker.
You know, it seems these days there is certainly, especially among younger audiences and younger people, a lot of activism and a lot of enthusiasm about changing things, but the architecture is not evident. And mm-hmm. It would seem to me that maybe now more than ever, somebody like Ella Baker and her example of sort of how to pull it together and create the trellis
are out there, and we don't have to look to national leaders to provide that. I think they are in our communities.
I want to thank you so much, Scholar Lee Williams, who joined us to talk about her new book for young adults about civil rights leader Ella Baker. The book is called We Who Believe in Freedom, The Life and Times of Ella Baker. Lee Williams, thank you so very much.
sir. Don't sit in front of that telly like a fly stuck in a toffee. It's a great big world out there.
Been there, done it.
I know. We could have a tea party on the ceiling.
Shh, TV.
Before Christopher Scott went to prison, he led a quiet life, spending as much time as possible with his sons.
In the place that I lived, we had like a pond. So I used to take my two boys out and go feed the ducks because they used to just like to hear how the ducks quacked. And, you know, there was my everyday life, just going to work, coming home, taking care of my kids and my girlfriend.
Then Scott was arrested and convicted for a murder he didn't commit. He was locked up for 13 years before the real killer confessed. Scott knew he had to stay out of trouble when he was in prison because if he was ever proven innocent, he wanted to be able to walk free. So how did he walk the straight line? We spoke to him about that as part of our fandom series.
Four things kept me out of trouble. Working in the kitchen, going to the gym, reading three books per week, and the most important thing was the soap opera. The first time I watched the soap opera in prison, I walked to the day room and they was watching soap opera. And they was like, hey, dude, you know, this is the soap opera side of the day room where people watch soap opera. I was like, oh, this is the side that I need to be on. I got a crew of men that in the world and society was killers. One of them named Baby Shaq because he was a big guy like Shaquille O'Neal. We had a guy named T-Bone and we had Slim 50. These were some of the hardest core fighting guys. But when that soap opera came on, you can hear a pin drop on cotton. It's like all eyes, don't nobody want to blink because if you feel like if you blink, you're going to miss something.
Brenda's in trouble.
That's because she was injected with a neurotoxin. In less than an hour, Brenda won't be able to breathe. So, Sonic, what matters more to you, revenge against me or saving Brenda's absurd little life?
We gave General Hospital a new name. We didn't call it General Hospital no more. We called it the Dope because it was addictive. We walked down the hallway, they shout, hey, did you see the Dope yesterday? And we had to share with each other all day long. Like, hey, did you see this scene where Jason shot at the guy and he rescued Sonny and they dove in the water and they had to swim 2-3 miles to get away and they carried on to the kitchen where we all went to work at. It was like, oh, they finna come in here and talk about the Dope today. We were like, yeah, if you don't want to hear about this Dope, you might as well move around because we finna keep talking about it.
I want to marry you.
Oh my God.
No, wait. No. Seriously. I want to marry you more than anything in the whole world.
You know, watching these love stories in a day room full of guys, you know, they made little snide remarks of, it's pretty much for women and females or whatever the case may be. But we didn't care about that because they knew the guy that was watching the soap opera probably couldn't kick half of the cell block he lived on. But, you know, it was this one character on General Hospital named Sonny Corinthos.
I don't want any trouble.
Well, that's too late. You own a clinic in Russia. You kept my friend prisoner. You drugged him to keep him in control.
And he ran the whole town and he had a bunch of businesses everywhere, but his main business was coffee imported. So I was telling myself, well, you know, this kind of an inspiration to me, so I need to watch this guy and get some knowledge.
But on a serious note, be careful, be smart, and most important, stay alive.
And he used to hide whatever he was trying to ship in a barrel under the coffee beans and it gets shipped out the country. So I looked at it, I said, man, you know, that may be a good way to move things in prison. And my job was working in the kitchen. So what I did, I created this hamburger business, but you got to get everything past the guards to get it where you have to go. So I used to take an ice bucket and line cardboard at the bottom of the ice barrel. And I used to sit 60 hamburgers and 60 orders of fries on a cardboard, and then I put another cardboard on top of it so when the officers raised the lid up, they couldn't see it because it was underneath the ice. So once I got to the cell block, I dumped the ice out and sell them. And dude, I was like the black Wendy's or the black Ronald McDonald in prison. And there was kind of like that entrepreneurship that I learned from watching soap operas. The soap operas really, it resonated a lot about missing home. Missing the arguing you heard your mom and dad have.
Jason is a Quartermain, and he belongs back here in this house.
I'm not going to resort to manipulating.
You miss the sisters fighting over the bathroom. You miss the brothers, you know, going outside shooting basketball in the backyard. So, yeah, it resonated hard and heavy. Like, just say holiday seasons.
Hey, Michael, it's your dad. I just wanted to wish you a Merry Christmas.
You see the soap opera people, they got the big Christmas trees. You know, they dress nice in red and white and all these pretty, you know, Christmas colors. And it made you want to be a part of that. It made you be like, I remember when we used to put candy canes on the Christmas trees. And when my mom went to sleep, we used to sneak and eat them off the Christmas tree. And seeing it on TV, I'm going to tell you, I didn't want people to see me cry or shed a tear. But every now and then, that happened. So I had to go in my cell. And I used to hang a sheet up. And the sheet would cover my whole cell. And I just used to go in my cell and have a big cry about it. Wasn't bad tears. It was good tears because I know I still had a heart. Because being falsely in prison, sometimes it hardens that heart to where you don't want to show a sign of weakness. So, you know, I know watching soap operas helped me with my dilemma. And we all can learn a lesson about how we choose not to judge people about what they think or what they watch. Because we all need something to hold on to.
Christopher Scott was exonerated after 13 years in prison. When he got out, he kept up that entrepreneurial spirit that he learned on General Hospital. He created a detective agency that looked into other innocence cases. His story is going to be featured in an upcoming PBS documentary called True Conviction. And yes, he still watches every episode of General Hospital.
Patients who don't take their medicine as directed not only risk their health, they cost about $100 billion a year, according to one study about avoidable costs in medicine. That's because the patients often end up sicker or needing additional treatment. Enter a new digital pill, just approved for use by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, in people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and other forms of mental illness. It actually lets your doctor know if you've taken it.
The problem of not adhering to treatment when it's administered on a regular basis, daily, multiple times a day, and the way that that compromises the effectiveness of the treatment is a huge problem in medicine, and particularly in treatment of mental disorders.
The pill's sensor is made of copper, magnesium, and silicon, ingredients already found in foods. It generates an electrical signal when it comes into contact with stomach fluids. That signal is then picked up by a wearable patch on the patient's rib cage. The patch sends the date, time, and patient activity level via Bluetooth to an app on the patient's mobile phone and a database to which researchers have access. Through the app, the patient can have a record sent of every time he or she takes the pill to up to four people, family members or caregivers. But the technology raises questions about privacy. Medical ethics experts find the fact that the pill is prescribed for mental illness especially troubling.
If you give someone a pill that's going to record for someone else whether they've taken the medication or not, it poses problems. These are people who may not understand all the issues because they involve because they have a psychiatric condition, though many people with psychiatric conditions can understand all the issues. There are problems because this may feed into their paranoia. They may think, oh, my God, people want to spy on me, and now the doctor is saying he's going to give me a drug that's going to spy on me.
The cost of the drug is another concern, prompting experts to say more study will be necessary to weigh the risks versus the benefits and make this pill easier to swallow. Kristen Salumi, Al Jazeera, New York.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
The United States regulates the organ and tissue transplant industry, but not when it comes to the sale of body parts. When people donate their bodies to research, their loved ones often don't know how their remains will be stored or even used. Reuters investigative reporters John Schiffman and Brian Groh have explored this in a recent series called The Body Trade. They also look at how some companies are making millions from these donations, which often come from poor families or friends who can't afford funerals for their loved ones. John Schiffman and Brian Groh join us now. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
How does donating a body or body parts differ from donating an organ?
Well,
Should I address these questions? I'm sure you both know the answers to pretty much every question I'm going to ask. Should I address it to each of you? So because we are both with us by phone, and you can't look to, can't give each other any eye contact to suggest that this one's yours.
John, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Sure. Well, the difference between transplant organs and non-transplant organs are, obviously, transplant organs are hearts, livers, anything that can be transferred in between one human being to another to preserve or extend life.
We just heard and that a whole face was transplanted recently.
That's true.
Okay, I'm sorry I interrupted you with that. I just thought it was an interesting news story. I don't know if you've been following that. But okay, so that's a transplant. What about the organ parts?
Sure. So the non-transplant are like arms, legs, whole heads, a torso, and they're used for medical research and all sorts of education and training. Say paramedics learn how to use a tracheotomy to perform one in an emergency situation. They'd rather practice on a live human being.
Brian,
and you need to be able to access those and get body parts to medical researchers and to medical educators and trainers.
Ryan, what regulations exist for organ donors and how the organs are stored?
So organ donors are part of a market that is heavily regulated. You know, what we traditionally understand as an organ donor is someone who's donating a heart or a kidney to go into another living human being. And the federal government has extensive regulation of that market. You must be a nonprofit if you're going to recover such body parts, and they strictly regulate how they're distributed and specifically prohibit their sale. But on the non-transplant side, there are virtually no rules. There's no federal law, and there are only a handful of state laws. And that's because the vast majority of regulation was written for the transplant market. And as a result, on the non-transplant side, you have a virtual free-for-all where almost anything can go. We found that almost anyone can open up a body broker firm to solicit bodies for research and education, dissect them, and then sell them. And the conditions in which they are stored and distributed vary, depending upon the company and the policies and procedures it's decided to implement.
Haven't cadavers often been used as teaching tools in medical schools? Do universities, did the medical schools have rules?
Medical schools have more sophisticated policies and procedures by and large. That's not to say there haven't been problems with medical schools. But the difference largely is that bodies donated to a university usually stay at that university. There is no sale of those body parts to third parties. And then after medical students train on them, they're cremated and returned to the family. But what we have here in our investigation is a look at private businesses that have flourished over the last few decades amid a lack of regulation. Because they realize there's huge demand for human body parts, and they can provide the supply. You know, in their case, they're soliciting donors over the internet at retirement communities, through hospices, hospitals, and funeral homes. and then dissecting those parts with the sole discretion of what to keep and what to return to the family, and then selling those parts to third-party end users that range from medical device companies to surgical training programs.
Do any states monitor the donations and the sales of body parts? John?
There are about a handful of states that truly monitor this in any significant way, but they all do it differently. Virginia, Oklahoma, New York, Florida do it to some extent. Other states have passed laws but don't enforce them at all. New Jersey has a law that says you have to be a nonprofit, but they've never really implemented the law. But we found throughout the West there's virtually no regulation whatsoever. With the one exception is in Oregon, you have to get a license and you get inspected every 2 years. Unlike the transplant side, where there's rigorous inspection and reporting requirements, there's virtually no strong inspection process or government oversight at all.
What kinds of body parts can you buy, and how much does a body part cost?
We find that, you know, just like any market, firms are going to price, at the maximum that they can get, and so prices fluctuate. And we found human heads going for $300 to $500.
And why would somebody buy a human head?
Well, there's all sorts of very important training and research that requires a human head to be able to do it in a way that trains the doctors or allows the research to have the right conditions for what they're seeking. So from young dentists who are learning to do implants to surgeons wanting to test out a new tool that would allow them to access the brain. Many uses for a human head.
So pretty much all of the sales are to researchers or to medical schools?
No. On the contrary, there are other uses too. One of our stories documents how the U.S. Army has bought human body parts from private brokers to use in blast experiments designed to, in that case, develop a mannequin that could be used to train how to improve how military vehicles defend against roadside blasts. In that particular case, what we found, however, is that many of the donors who ended up with the military in those blast test experiments had specifically said they did not want to go to the military as part of their donation, a violation of their consent.
I'm speaking with Brian Groh and John Schiffman, who have written a series for Reuters called The Body Trade. Why do people donate these bodies? Is it a matter of not being able to pay for a funeral?
Sure. Well, there are two real reasons that people donate. One is altruism, which is wanting to provide for others and to benefit science. But the second reason, and the reason that we found more prevalent, is that these body donation firms offer free cremation if you donate your body. The average funeral costs about $7,000 for burial and ceremonies and that sort of thing. And if you choose cremation, it costs between, say, $500 and $1,000. And so what the funeral homes and the donation firms do is they solicit people by saying, we'll give you a free cremation. You won't have to pay for anything. We'll pick it up, the body, we'll take care of everything, we'll return cremated remains.
But they're not paying for the body, and they're not giving the donor any say in how the body would be used?
That's right. That's right. They make general, vague, promises that it might go to help cure certain diseases, but the body brokers can't guarantee and won't guarantee necessarily where the bodies will go. And what people don't seem to realize is that the bodies will be dissected and sold, and they'll also be leased, which is something that we found very surprising. So the same head might be leased or rented, you know, three or four times. The same shoulder might be used three or four times as a way of making money. You could look at it as either making money, but you could also look at it as getting the most out of that donated body part.
Now, you mentioned that New Jersey had a law that only allowed for nonprofit body brokers. Are there nonprofit body brokers throughout the country?
There
or is this
some.
just a lucrative business?
So one of the things that we found is that there's a significant lack of transparency in the body broker market. And there's no registry of firms. There's no trade group keeping track of who's in the market. So we sought, you know, to do something very fundamental. Who's in the body broker business? And we found more than 30 firms active in the market over the last 5 years, of which two-thirds were for-profit and the rest were non-profit.
And if I wanted to get into this business, what do I have to do? Do I just register myself as a body broker?
In most states, you wouldn't even have to do that. You would just have to get a business license. In, say, for example, Colorado, you need a special license to cut hair. You need a special license to drive a cab. In New York, you would need to go and get a license. In Oregon, you'd need to get a license. But in the vast majority of states, it's just another business. There's no special requirements at all. You would just need some startup costs, which would be a van, some freezers, perhaps some equipment to dissect the bodies, and a willingness to go out and knowledge of sales, of convincing people to donate their bodies to your business.
A listener, Tim Brew, asks on Twitter, if I'm an organ donor on my New York State driver's license, what does that mean in this context?
In this context, it means that Tim has authorized transplant tissue banks to recover organs and tendons and skin. And that's the heavily regulated part of the market.
So that would not be going to the body broker?
No. That would be something that Tim would have to choose to do separately. And, you know, depending upon which firm he went to, he should receive and fill out a consent form authorizing that type of donation. And in some cases, both can happen. So a transplant organization might recover some specimens, and the individual could also be a body donor. And that firm to which he donated would receive the rest and decide what it might want to keep and distribute.
I'm wondering about the review of court police and internal broker records that Reuters did. How many instances of body parts being misused or abused have you found since 2004?
We found nearly 2,500 body parts that had been misused since 2004.
You also say desecrated.
Right. So there were instances where they were simply abandoned or thrown into medical waste, where they ended up, not to get too graphic, but they ended up moldy at the, you know, were abandoned in storage lockers, just in, you know, things that are medically inappropriate and undignified to and disrespectful to the people who donated to the bodies. And a lot of times this happened. A lot of these people who did this, you know, they went in going out of business, declaring bankruptcies. They had tax liens. I mean, they were bad businessmen to boot.
And they couldn't just have passed those body parts on to other businesses that might have wanted them?
Well, technically they could have, because they have sole discretion what to do with the body part once they received them. And we definitely saw that brokers distribute to each other. If somebody's in need of an extra set of heads, you know, another broker might be the supplier. But in these instances, we found that the businesses or the businessmen were just getting out of the business and didn't want to properly take care of or properly cremate and return the body parts that in the way that it should have been done.
Hurricane Harvey caused industrial facilities in Texas to release an extra 6 million pounds of pollution into the air. People who live and work near the plants are still worried about what they breathed in after the storm. And, as NPR's Rebecca Hershey reports, many are frustrated with the federal government's response.
Here are the directions Juan Flores gave me to find his house. It's east of Houston. You go past the Kinder Morgan pipeline, past the Magellan gas storage tanks. If you get to the railroad tracks leading to the Shell refinery, you've gone too far. His town, Galena Park, is small. Lots of kids, lots of pets. And it's surrounded by petrochemical companies.
A lot of my family that comes from Mexico will come and visit us, and they'll come here and say, Juan, don't you smell that? I'm like, smell what? Don't you smell that burnt smell in the air? I'm like, I don't smell nothing.
Juan's used to it. He's lived here since he was four. But after the floods from Hurricane Harvey, he says it was bad.
My eyes are watering. We never smelled it this bad. Some people left Galena Park because they're like, man, I can't take this. People would turn off their ACs. I mean, there was no shelter in place, but we were like, we wonder why, but we're all wondering that.
Shelter in place. That's when the government announces there's something dangerous in the air. Stay inside. Close the windows. But after Harvey, nothing. Just the strong smell of gasoline. Juan does community outreach for an air quality nonprofit in Houston called Air Alliance. So he knew to look for information from the Environmental Protection Agency. But for a week, the EPA's press releases didn't include air quality information.
We released our data as it became available.
Sam Coleman is the acting administrator for the EPA region that includes Texas. He points out the EPA's air monitors, which are sprinkled all around the region, including in Juan Flores's town, had to be shut off as Harvey approached so they wouldn't be damaged by the storm. It took about a week to get most of them up and running again. In the meantime, the agency had a mobile air testing unit driving around and another one on an airplane overhead. Coleman says it all went pretty well compared to past hurricanes.
For example, after Katrina, we found that there were often some circumstances where EPA and the state could not really communicate data very quickly and accurately. And we feel like we corrected that in this response by getting the information out in just a matter of days after it was collected.
EPA's first statement about air quality in the Houston area came 8 days after the storm arrived. It said, quote, air quality at this time is not concerning, and local residents should not be concerned about air quality issues related to the effects of the storm. Christopher Sellers studies environmental history and the EPA at Stony Brook University. He says he's seen these kinds of reassuring statements before.
That's classic. That is a tried and true, not just for environmental agencies, but for public health agencies in general.
The problem is often that while government officials don't have a lot of data, they still feel pressure to say something.
They feel like they cannot admit uncertainty about dangers, particularly in the face of possible public panic.
The implications can be serious. For example, he says, after 9/11, health officials reassured the public about the air around Ground Zero, despite the fact that there actually wasn't any good data about the air quality there. Years later, long-term studies found thousands of workers had gotten sick from the air. Sellers says the underlying problem is that the EPA is not particularly well-equipped for emergencies, especially ones that involve invisible plumes of mixed chemicals wafting through neighborhoods. Still, he says, history tells us it's better to be open about limitations and uncertainty.
To say, you know, nothing's wrong when you don't know, you got to be honest and you got to level with people.
Which is exactly what Juan Flores wants. By the time the EPA put out a press release saying there was nothing to worry about, he'd been smelling gas in his neighborhood for days.
I mean, God, we smelled it. Why try to hide it? I mean, we're not idiots. I mean, You can tell us all you want. There's no, y'all good guys. Y'all got nothing to worry about. We're the ones smelling it. You can't take that. I mean, you can't hide that.
It came out later that 500,000 gallons of gasoline had spilled around the corner from Flores's house. That's almost certainly what he had been smelling. It was the biggest known petrochemical leak caused by Harvey. The EPA says a, quote, significant amount evaporated into the air. Inhaling gasoline can cause respiratory problems. In larger amounts, it can damage organs or even cause cancer.
Believe me, I think about it every day. I was like, I wonder how many years of my life I'm end up losing because I live out here, but it's home.
Yet, he says, if he has to leave his home to keep his family safe, he will. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Have Black lives ever mattered? An introduction. Does the title of this work seem provocative? If so, then good. That's how it's intended to be. For if the question is provocative, then what of the answer? Is not the answer, no matter how damning, far more provocative? And yet, who dares answer in any way other than the negative? There is an old axiom, especially among journalists and journalism professors, that today's newspapers are the first draft of history. Like most axioms, they hold a kernel of truth, but there is more. Here is another axiom. History is written by the victors. The words that follow on these pages were not written by a victor, but by one who has seen and sensed what was happening on the other side of a prison wall, who seeks to convey those impressions with truth, and who has often done so several times a week. In a sense, the impressions recorded in these pages ahead are a form of history. Black history, recorded during a particular passage of time. During this particular period, we experienced the greatest economic disaster since the Great Depression of the 1930s. The cultural dominance of hip-hop, the nation's fever over mass incarceration, the Obama presidency, the spread of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the unexpected onset of the Donald J. Trump era. True history, what Howard Zinn called the people's history, is the one which gives us voices of ordinary people and create, through these words, their ordinary struggles. And yet for blacks, much that never makes it to the newspapers, or if so, only in a distorted form, still leaves scars in the mind, evidence of trauma sustained from simply existing as a black person in the United States of America. The pages ahead reflect the people's struggles in the invisible sectors of American society, sectors which, by a terrible necessity, are populated largely by blacks, Latinos, immigrants, the incarcerated, and those with little income. The pages ahead are also, by equal necessity, reflections of insurgent, emergent, radical, and revolutionary aspiration, thinking, and living. For from oppression comes solidarity, resistance, rebellion, and change. National movements like Black Lives Matter are manifestations of such solidarity and resistance, and give voice to the eruption of outrage, angst, hopes, and insurgent protest provoked by each new killing. That such a movement was brought into being by three young women of color, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, and Alicia Garza, is telling, for throughout American history, we have seen how the dedicated efforts of women of color have driven resistance networks and liberation movements. These determined sisters have both studied history and altered it, and continue to do so today. You've been listening to the opening words, an introduction to the book, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? This is its author, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I am here not just to read these words, but to thank you for coming to this party, to greet you, all of you, old, young, straight, gay, black, Latino, brown, yellow, of every color, of every character, of every age, of every gender, for daring to join me here tonight, at least in spirit. I thank you. I welcome you. And believe it or not, I love you, each and every one of you, for being part of this day and this movement. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal saying, I love you all.
It's hurtful to know that somebody here feels that way.
As if studying for midterms wasn't stressful enough, students at UC San Diego classes are trying to understand why someone put dozens of racial slurs in their study guide.
10 News reporter Amanda Brandeis talked to a student in the class who says it's not the first time this has happened.
The word is in here 85 times. One student in the class believes it's an example of a toxic computer science culture. On nearly every page is a word so hurtful.
You can see it everywhere, the word.
No one wants to say it out loud.
Even if they did do it as a joke, like that's never okay. Like that's not something that you would just, it's not something you play around with.
I get on the study guide and I saw the instance of the N-word. And then I notice another instance.
Raymond DeRevolo says only students in the computer science class had access to the study guide and that they could make changes anonymously. DeRevolo says what might look like a harmless prank is far from it.
I needed to just bring it to light because that wasn't the first time it's happened.
So he shared screenshots online. DeRevolo says it's far too common for women and minorities to feel targeted in the computer science field dominated by men.
People continue to do these things, knowing that they won't get in trouble. And it's like a small joke to them. So if the person were to get in trouble, that would be nice.
It's not really a prank. It's kind of just an attack.
We're here to learn and get educated, not make others feel ashamed or
threatened
for just being them.
I feel like
Arevalo says some students weren't bothered by what happened and believes that's a problem.
Will the school do anything? Probably not. Can they do something? Probably, yeah.
Amanda Brandeis, 10 News.
And we have reached out to the professor for comment, but did not hear back.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
The University of Hartford student accused of a controversial racial incident against her former roommate goes to court tomorrow. News 8's Bob Wilson is live in Hartford with a preview of the case against Brianna Rochu. Bob.
Yeah, you know, you can call it a despicable crime. One roommate allegedly using her own bodily fluids against her other roommate to get her to move out. She didn't like her, something along those lines. Police are still trying to put it all together. However, she was never charged with a hate crime, a white roommate against a black roommate, and she heads off to court tomorrow.
No justice, no peace!
There's been an NAACP rally at the West Hartford Police Department. Protests on the University of Hartford campus, anger and frustration in the black community.
And even if she didn't get sick, you can't do that to somebody and then get misdemeanor charges. No, that's a hate crime. That's violent. You should be expelled.
University of Hartford student Brianna Bruchot arrested for allegedly terrorizing her black roommate, Chanel Jazzy Rowe, and then bragging about it on Instagram last month. Finally did it, yo girl, got rid of her roommate. After 1.5 months of spitting in her coconut oil, putting moldy clam dip in her lotions, and rubbing used tampons on her backpack, putting her...
That the crime itself is motivated specifically and only by someone's race, their gender, their sexual orientation, their religion.
Professor Mullen says making a roommate sick with bodily fluids can fall under a wide range of charges. The state's attorney's office can add hate crimes in court tomorrow if they think they can prove it.
Often students are put together in rooms and it doesn't work out for a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with race, sexual orientation, religion, or any of the categories that are protected by hate crime statutes.
Now, the West Hartford Police Department says they have completed their investigation, turned it over to the state's attorney's office. We'll see if they up it to a hate crime tomorrow in court. I'm Bob Wills reporting hot live in the Hartford Newsroom, News 8.
When you're a cop, you can torment freely in Simi Valley, then season Audi, then beam proudly. Turn a routine traffic stop to your season finale when you're a cop.
A sheriff in Georgia has been suspended after the governor, Nathan Deal, decided to suspend him following the sheriff signing off on the search of 900 high school students while police officers were looking for drug paraphernalia. No drug paraphernalia was found. However, these students were on lockdown for hours. Their cell phones were taken away from them. And the searches were much more invasive than what you would expect. And so a grand jury did indict the police officer that I'm talking about, the sheriff. His name is Jeff Hobby. And two deputies in connection with the search at Worth County High School. Hobby faces two counts of false imprisonment, one count of sexual battery, a charge of violating his oath of office. Now, according to the lawsuit, Hobby arrived at the school with a target list. He's looking for students who have drugs on them. Target list of 13 students that he suspected of having drugs. Only three of the listed students were at school that day, and Hobby had them brought to the administrative offices and searched. But that wasn't good enough for him. He decided, no, I want to go ahead and search 900 students. Think about what a gigantic waste of time and resources that is. They didn't find any drugs, no drug paraphernalia whatsoever, besides which, really, you're going to focus all your attention on this issue? Okay. The lawsuit says Hobby then put the entire school on lockdown. Students were confined to classrooms, hallways, and the gym. Their cell phones were taken away so they couldn't even call their parents. And so this is not looking good because there is a lawsuit filed by the parents of some of these students because they had their genitals touched. In some cases, they had their, you know, clothes taken off or certain articles of clothing lifted in front of other students, and it was humiliating. I mean, this is a very clear abuse of power, so much so that the governor of Georgia had to intervene and suspend this guy.
Yeah. I think this is a consequence of our addiction to policing and mm-hmm. our addiction to the surveillance state. I mean, and just to even think back to my own high school experience, the fact that we had a cop on campus all the time, that most schools had a list of clothing that you couldn't wear because it was, like, gang-affiliated, right? Like shoelace colors, right?
Yeah, it's funny. At my school, we didn't have, like, the gang colors or anything, but it was more – there was way more emphasis on the way female students dressed, right? And so if we can see your shoulders, you are – you're a harlot. And you must be taken to the principal's office, that kind of stuff. But you're right. Like, we didn't have a police officer. We had, like, a really, like, jolly, like, security guard guy named Jerry that I have fond memories
nice.
Of. Right? He was really nice. But we never felt like we were on lockdown or being watched. We weren't treated as criminals. And I think when students are treated this way, remember, they're young. Their brains are still developing. Yeah. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, I think.
Right, yeah. right.
And there's ways. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it. We had an officer in uniform with his police car right in front of the entrance to the high school. Mm-hmm. So it's already priming our brains to expect that encounter with mm-hmm. the police. And that, again, not only criminalized, but you're on your toes because you think that you can possibly do something wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Whether or not it is suspecting them of drugs they don't have, but putting them in positions where they're made vulnerable and suspected of being a criminal, that's, I mean, when this starts young, like you said, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's also definitely part of a targeted effort to certain schools, like public schools. This doesn't happen at private schools. I don't see this happening at all.
Absolutely, and I'm sure, I guess this all started with a complaint from either a set of parents who were concerned about drugs at the school. If you've narrowed it down to a list of 13 students, you can go talk to them and their
right,
parents.
Right,
I'm sure
right.
that's what would have been done if the school were right. a private school, and that is, you know, an assumption. But there are ways of doing drug sweeps that are lawful, right? So this is both like incompetence and an overreach. So drug sweeps, they bring the dogs in. They don't pull students out of class. You don't interrupt. Students are here to learn.
That's right. Yeah.
Right? So when you interrupt that process, it better be for good reason. This is not good reason. And I just feel like with minors, there's issues of like consent, with their bodies being touched in terms of these searches.
They're minors, exactly. Yes.
So it's just, it's wildly inappropriate.
So I did a little more digging because I wanted to learn more about this sheriff. I wanted to know if he had, you know, a record of complaints, you know, had he abused his power in the past. And I came across this little kernel of information that I wanted to share with you guys.
It's going to be juicy.
It's good. Let's go to graphic 29. The sheriff now stands accused by the local prosecutor of interfering with the criminal investigation into his teenage son, Zachary Lewis Hobby, who's 17. The younger Hobby was arrested on October 9th and charged with felony possession of marijuana with intent to distribute and criminal trespass. Sheriff Hobby and his wife, who is also an employee of the Worth County Sheriff's Office, barged into the room ostensibly to invoke the 17-year-old's Fifth Amendment rights for him. So he got involved.
This is more than juicy.
I mean, come on.
This is
come
like,
on.
This is like the Republican twist to the story of being against trans rights and then being caught in a bathroom. Yeah, this is that twist.
Yes.
You needed to be searching your own house for the drugs because that's apparently where they were.
I mean, who knows? Yeah. And maybe that's the reason why he was so overzealous with these other students. Because maybe he looks at his son and he's like, oh, look at what my son got into. It's because of the influence of some other person. So I don't know. I'm doing pop psychology here.
Yeah,
I don't
but
know
that's
what I'm
parenting.
About.
That's not right? like, that's not.
You don't get to abuse your power and treat other students that way. And it's just, it's amazing. Like he'll stick up for his son, but he'll go ahead and strip search other innocent students who should be on campus to learn. You're absolutely right.
900 students.
It's a lot of people. Yeah.
When I first heard his name, I had no idea who he was. I thought of a prominent gay actor with a raspy voice and could make no sense of the reports. Although known by many in Hollywood, he barely burst the bubble to the outer world. But before long, a dam had burst. A famous woman from the biggest blockbusters of the last few decades saying that the executive sexually assaulted or harassed him. Well, it gave birth to Me Too, to quote the hashtag. And it didn't end with Weinstein. A who's who of male Hollywood were outed as sexual abusers. And then, miraculously, the river burst its banks, and the names of nationally known politicians began to fill the air. What we're witnessing beginning of a movement, augmented by social media, yes, but also animated by real, live women, as shown by the unprecedented mobilization of women shortly after Trump's unexpected win in the presidency. That's because social movements first change consciousness, then they change society itself. When I was a youth, I heard hints and whispers about the casting couch. It was simply the way things were. How many women accepted such vile treatment on their road to fame and fortune, only to find that everything that glitters ain't gold? Today, because of the courage of such women, we are seeing the extraordinary costs of such a couch. But this time, the men in power are paid the price. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
First song they played for me was about their friend that just died. Texting and driving.
Tough new laws against handling a cell phone behind the wheel took effect this summer and fall in Washington and Oregon. So how's it working?
Correspondent Tom Bonsi has some answers from a legislative briefing in Olympia.
The Oregon and Washington legislatures this year both made it illegal to drive while holding an electronic device for most any reason. This covers phones, tablets, video games, and the like. The Washington Traffic Safety Commission got a peek at behavior changes through a private company's smartphone app. The commission's Shelley Baldwin says app data shared by True Motion showed a dip in distracted driving during the two-week burst of publicity when the new law started.
However, they see that it has gone pretty much back up to what it was before. So we're looking forward to January when we're enforcing.
A Washington State Patrol captain said troopers have stopped nearly 5,000 drivers since July for distracted driving violations, but most got away with just a warning during the six-month educational phase-in of the toughened law. Oregon's new distracted driving law took effect on October 1st, so it's too soon to assess. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
Best for last, this is Congresswoman Karen Bass, black female. She had the opportunity to question United States Attorney General and suspected racist Jeff Sessions this week about the FBI's report on black identity extremists.
Between 1956 and 1971, the FBI ran a counterintelligence program named COINTELPRO that was initiated by J. Edgar Hoover. COINTELPRO mainly targeted civil rights leaders such as Martin Luther King, and it's commonly understood that this was an abuse of its surveillance power in a manner to suppress a peaceful movement. So I would like to ask, Mr. Chair, unanimous consent to enter this report into the record, which is black identity extremists likely motivated to target law enforcement officers. I believe earlier you said you were not familiar with the report. Is that correct?
Well, I haven't read it. I know some of the alleged targeting of officers by
okay, so I would
group.
Like to know, and I'll ask you about that in a minute. So you are somewhat familiar with it. Who had the power in your department to order a report like this?
I'm not sure how that report got ordered. I don't believe I explicitly approved it or directed it.
Okay, so you haven't necessarily read the report, but you are familiar with the term black identity extremists?
Well, I think so, yes.
So can you tell me what that term means to you? Do you believe that there is a movement of African Americans that identify themselves as black identity extremists, and what does that movement do?
Well, it'd be interesting to see the conclusions of that report. But I'm aware that there are groups that do have an extraordinary commitment to their racial identity, and some have transformed themselves even into violent activists.
Are you aware of white organizations that do this as well? Given that white supremacy is well-documented, well-researched movements such as the neo-Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, et cetera, are they white identity extremists?
I didn't follow that question, please, again.
Is there a term or a report on white identity extremists? You mentioned you were familiar with black people who identify with their racial identity.
Yes, but it's not coming to me at this moment.
Not coming to you?
It's
certainly a group such as the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes, and then the skinhead movements, but there's a racial identity, white movements, that have been identified for sure.
So has the FBI done a report on white identity extremists that are likely motivated to target law enforcement officers?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Are you aware of a group called the Sovereign Citizens?
I've heard that group, yes.
And I believe that the Sovereign Citizens is primarily a white organization that absolutely has targeted police officers and killed police officers. You're not aware of that?
I'm not aware of all their crimes, but I know they are a group that's known to have violent tendencies.
Could you name an African-American organization that have committed violent acts against police officers? Could you name one today? In this report, they name organizations from 30, 40 years ago, but can you name of one today that has targeted police officers in a violent manner?
I believe I could, but I would want to be to confirm that and submit it to you in writing. But I believe we had, within the last year or so, four police officers killed by a group that some have described as extremist.
So what has happened is that there have been a couple of incidents in which African-Americans did kill police officers who were not associated with a black organization. And so one, for example, in Baton Rouge was associated with Sovereign Citizens, which is primarily a white group. So you should know that there's a lot of concern in the community, especially from organizations such as Black Lives Matter. By the way, would you consider Black Lives Matter a black identity extremist group?
I'm not able to comment on that. I have not so declared it.
So you should know that a lot of activists around the country are very concerned that we're getting ready to repeat a very sad chapter of our history, where people who are rightfully protesting what they consider to be an injustice in their community, which is their relationship with police officers, are now being targeted and labeled as extremists and are going through periods of surveillance and harassment. And so I would like to know, what is your department going to do to protect the rights of average citizens to protest if they have a concern about police officers?
This department will not unlawfully target people.
So if that's the case, then I would ask that you review this report, Black Identity Extremists Likely Motivated to Target Law Enforcement Officers, because I personally don't believe that any such organizations exist. The organizations that are referred to in this report are organizations from decades ago. And so I would like to know, what will you do to essentially roll back what is listed in this report? Because it's not accurate. Sir?
We will look at the report. I actually would be interested in reading it. But they usually do an excellent job, objective and fair, on those kind of reports.
Okay, well, just...
Time of the gentlewoman has expired.
Objective and fair.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 18th. 2017, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, views from the past 7 days, any of the news clips that we heard. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943. Pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the callers. First, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. That is the address for my blog. Again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested nearly a decade of counter-racist programming. I hope it has helped black people, non-white people, get an accurate understanding of what racism, white supremacy is and how it works. You can also support visiting the wish list at Amazon.com. It's under Gus T. Renegade. It's also linked on the blog. Again, huge thanks to all the generous listeners who supported the wish list, supported the cows. I hope it has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Let folks know, yesterday, Friday, we started our new book in the book club, Kevin Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths. Longtime listeners will recall that Dr. Niana Rasayan years ago recommended this book. Wow, we've only read one chapter. Already, I would say it might be threatening Gus T. Renegade's top 10 list. Certainly, we have a ways to go, but lots of striking information. I'm looking forward to reading more. And, of course, since Kevin Dutton is a suspected racist, Still, I think we've already had examples of him perhaps practicing white supremacy within the text. But fascinating read, might be worth checking out if you don't check out the book club, or if you're just looking for something to read. Wisdom of Psychopaths might be a book worth flipping through. Also, speaking of Wisdom of Psychopaths, that segment on the body parts industry, wow. We read in my top 10, top five, actually, Harriet A. Washington's Medical Apartheid, and she had a lot of really important information about the long, and I mean like centuries long, tradition of pillaging black carcasses, black corpses for body parts and organs and all of that, and talking about how this continues right up till today, 21st century. That is definitely information that should be shared. And I mean, just the layers that were revealed in that report, where they're leasing out body parts, leasing out a head or a shoulder 3-4 different times. I mean, wow. System of White Supremacy. There was a op-ed in the New York Times authored by Jay-Z Friday morning. It was titled, "The Criminal Justice System Stalks Black People Like Meek Mill." This is in the New York Times. Reading is more important than watching television. I posted it on my Facebook page. I wanted to read it just so you'd have that on the record to see what he says. So he writes, "This month, Meek Mill was sentenced to 2 to 4 years in prison for violating his probation. Hashtag Free Meek have sprung up, and hundreds of his fans rallied near City Hall in Philadelphia to protest the ruling. On the surface, this may look like the story of yet another criminal rapper who didn't smarten up and is back where he started. But consider this. Meek was around 19 when he was convicted on charges related to drug and gun possession, and he served an 8-month sentence. Now he's 30, so he has been on probation for basically his entire adult life. For about a decade, he's been stalked by a system that considers the slightest infraction a justification for locking him back inside. What's happening to Meek Mill is just one example of how our criminal justice system entraps and harasses hundreds of thousands of black people every day. I saw this up close when I was growing up in Brooklyn during the 1970s and 1980s. Instead of a second chance, probation ends up being a landmine with a random misstep bringing consequences greater than the crime. A person on probation can end up in jail over a technical violation like missing a curfew. Taxpayers in Philadelphia, Meek Mill's hometown, will have to spend tens of thousands of dollars each year to keep him locked up, and I bet none of them would tell you his imprisonment is helping to keep them safer. He's there because of arrest for a parole violation and because a judge overruled recommendations by a prosecutor and his probation officer that he doesn't deserve more time, more jail time. That's why I stopped my show in Dallas last week to talk about Meek. Look at what he's being punished for now. In March, he was arrested after an altercation in a St. Louis airport. After video of what had actually happened was released, all charges were dropped against Meek. In August, he was arrested for popping a wheelie on a motorcycle on his video set in New York. Those charges will be dismissed if he stays out of trouble. Think about that. The charges were either dropped or dismissed, but the judge sent him to prison anyway. The specifics of Meek's case inspired me to write this, but it's time we highlight the random ways people trapped in the criminal justice system are punished every day. The system treats them as a danger to society, consistently monitors and follows them for any minor infraction with the goal of putting them back in prison. As of 2015, 1/3 of the 4.65 million Americans who were on some form of parole or probation were black. Black people are sent to prison for probation and parole violations at much higher rates than white people. In Pennsylvania, hundreds of thousands of people are on probation or parole. About half of the people in city jails in Philadelphia are there for probation or parole violations. We could literally shut down jails if we treated people on parole or probation more fairly. F word. And that's what we need to fight for in Philadelphia and across the country. The racial justice organization Color of Change is working with people in Philadelphia to pressure the courts there and make that vision a reality. Probation is a trap, and we must fight for Meek and everyone else unjustly sent to prison. Jay-Z, the criminal justice system, stalks black people like Meek Mill. Again, that was an op-ed published in the New York Times on Friday. I suspect it's probably in the paper today, Saturday, if you get the hard copy of the paper. But always grand to see black people, victims of racism, making an effort to speak out about the problem. And one thing that I can say, regardless of, you know, what you think or feel about Mr. Jay-Z and what he had to say, I do appreciate it not being the standard phrase blacks and Latinos. Continuing, one thing that I did want to make sure to get in, counter-racism, at least my understanding, my view of what the business of counter-racism is supposed to be about, the science of replacing white supremacy with justice. As it relates to non-white people victims of racism, there are no queens or kings. We have victims of racism, white supremacy, and if there are quote-unquote kings and queens of counter-racism, they will be crowned and easily recognizable when the problem has been solved. Continuing, that segment, it was one of the earlier news clips that we heard. Black male, greater confinement, there unjustly, related to many of the issues that Mr. Jay-Z was writing about, who said that he endured his unjust incarceration. He read 3 books a day. That was part of it. But what they focused on in the NPR report was the inmates' addiction to the dope, quote unquote, of General Hospital. Fascinating. I was so intrigued with that segment for so many reasons. I thought that this was another one. I would have appreciated getting much more detail on why he was incarcerated falsely, what business, how he's operating his business now that he's out, like what are some of the books that he was reading while he was there. He said he was had a regimen for reading these books. What books did he read that were significant or had a big impact on his thinking and allowed him to go ahead and navigate through his situation, keeping a relationship with his children? I mean, it was a lot of things that they could have talked about, but they focused on General Hospital and how that held these folks in rapture. Just amazing. And particularly to think that you have a lot of black people in prison watching a soap opera at that, with predominantly white characters, and how that helped them get through. Just wow. Reading is more important than watching television, and just reminded me of the power of those images and the narration and everything else that goes into television. It is so powerful, and it can do such a good job. I can see how television in general can be helpful in that sort of situation, in terms of taking your mind so that you're not focusing on the immediate problems and, oh man, I'm in incarceration and how am I going to be here, and I'm not even supposed to be here. I didn't even commit a crime. I'm a victim of white supremacy and all of this. I can see how television can be a tremendous distraction in that sort of environment, or even for those of us who are not in greater confinement, television continues to be an enormously effective sedative. Continuing. The Global Sunday Talk on Racism will be here tomorrow, tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, and 12 noon Pacific. Early broadcast so we can chat, exchange views with listeners, non-white people who are in different parts of the world. Tune in if you think it will be constructive. Looking forward to that. And we will be here on Wednesday. We will have a former firefighter from the Miami, Florida area Mr. William Clark will be visiting the program. He was a part of the Opa-locka 3. If retired firefighter is here, I suspect he might be able to give a slight synopsis of what the Opa-locka 3 case was about, but also thought it would be great to talk to him about the recent incident with the firefighters down in Miami, where it was a whole gang, of race soldiers in the fire department who were carrying out these racist acts. They just fired a number of them to get some of his thoughts on that situation as well. But he'll be with us, Mr. Clark, this coming Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. With that, we'll go ahead and get to some of the folks who dialed in. The number, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate for this broadcast. If we could not use metaphors, certainly we should be paying attention to the use of metaphors. They can reveal a lot about what a person thinks. Perhaps sometimes metaphors, these analogies, can reveal more than the speaker would like them to. That said, it's also been my observation that frequently racists, one of their main tools of deception is to use metaphors, analogies, comparisons. They will contrast two entities and swear that they are similar or equivalent. And frequently that is not the case at all. That is a major way of spreading confusion, deception. Racists, this is something that happens on a regular basis. Non-white people, we have been exposed to this behavior for a long amount of time. And many of us, Gus T. Renegade included, we are still learning. As such, we have not come to conclusions on some subject matters. And sometimes when we are discussing these issues, we will use a metaphor in place of logic, in place of areas where we have not come to a conclusion. And often it spreads more confusion. If we could speak explicitly, directly to what it is that we want to say without using at all metaphors, cliches, just be direct about what we want to say, that would be extremely helpful. I will prompt about that. If we could take about 5 minutes to share, that way everybody gets one opportunity to speak. And then if you have additional commentary, if you could just wait until everybody has spoken once, and then you can share if you have other comments or questions that you would like to share. Also, if you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be extremely helpful. No speakerphone as well, but just use your mute button. That way, if you go ahead, you speak, say what you have to say. And then if you can mute yourself, and then if you want to share more, you can just unmute, but just helps to preserve the quality of the audio broadcast. And other people don't have to have difficulties when they're trying to speak. Thank you kindly. With that, we will go ahead and get to the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have a line or a hand up, your line should be open.
Hey, how you doing, Gus?
Right, poorly.
All right. Two things I wanted to talk about. That was from the clip. Let me get my thoughts. Just fell out. I was about to say something. It just kind of escaped me. Okay, no, the over policing of the black community. The congresswoman who grilled Jeff Sessions. I want to say just this week. A police officer was shot in the head in Baltimore. And I was looking at the commentary of Willie D, a rapper who is in the ranks of less confused when it comes to racism and white supremacy. And he pointed out some things because after this police officer was shot in the head, Baltimore police went on a lockdown of said community in Baltimore. I don't recall when a police officer was killed by a white suspect when the whole community became under siege and also was held responsible for the shooting. They rolled through Baltimore in police armored trucks. They walked the streets with assault rifles. They even had Baltimore police cadets walking door to door trying to gather information about this shooting. So it alarmed me because right now that report that the FBI put out, it makes it seem like that there's a covert or secret group of entities in the black community that's targeting the police department. And the way the Baltimore police handled this police shooting proves evident that they view the whole black community as an enemy. So just to bring that to note. Not dealing with the clip. I want to say, you know, listening to the Cows, I've been listening to the Cows for, I want to say, about 2 years now. I listen to it when I'm at work. I can say that the Cows has made me less confused. It made me not speak in third person when I speak of black people, other victims. And I also noticed one thing too, Gus. When I go on iTunes, now I'm subscribed to many other channels, but for some reason, the Cows, I always have a problem clicking on to episodes. It says temporarily not available. There's no other podcast that I'm subscribed to that does this, only the Cows. However, there's two shows that I listened to, Gus, from you, real interesting. And then two was dealing with two callers, victims of white supremacy, that was kind of confused. Gay black male, the proud gay black male, I listened to that. I was listening closely, and he says that he listened to the Cows, and there's a lot of anti-gay programming with the Cows. I want to say that I've been binge watching the Cows, and I haven't heard anything. Matter of fact, Gus, I don't even hear none of your shows really focusing on homosexuality. And I also listened to the Oreo Experience. I would love to see those two guests, what their opinion is now under Trump, this Trump era. You know, and I just wanted to know, have those two guests, have they been in contact with you after the show on a continuous basis, yes or no?
The gay black male that was a guest on the program, he visited with us twice, and he was extremely discourteous and rude the second time that he was on the program. So I would not have it. I just don't continue to have conversation with people that are discourteous, particularly people that have asked to have some sort of dialogue with you, and then they're being rude and discourteous in talking to you. So no, I would not have any interest in having any further dialogue with him. He's, you know, said what he said, moving forward. Oreo Experience, she's been on the program multiple times, so it would depend on which time you heard her. Like, when I say multiple, more than three. So obviously we had some dialogue. It's been a minute since I've, or it's been some time since I've conversed with her. She does have a blog, so I'm sure you could check her blog and see what her thoughts are now that Trump is in office, right, to see if she's changed her opinion on white people or racism, white supremacy in general.
Right. Two more things and I'll let you go. In the third show, I would love to have, because the audio wasn't that clear, a gentleman named Prince Justice, and I'm going to order his book on Amazon. I would love for you to have him back, because when he called in, he wasn't quite clear on his line. If I got any other questions, I have some other stuff to say, but I'll wait toward the end of the show.
For sure. I think he was on the continent at the time in Nigeria, if memory serves, when he spoke with us. I know he was saying it was going to be, you know, just have to deal with what we could in terms of the phone connection. But I think that was 2011, if memory serves. He's friends on Facebook and has stayed in touch, so we could probably get him back on the program without too much difficulty, I suspect. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Just a few notes first on, I have actually started to get the Las Vegas newspaper, so I have something to say about a story in there. But the first thing, on the segment about the NPR segment about just the harvesting of bodies, I felt like the interviewer, I think it's the same white man who was always interviewing. I felt like he was definitely practicing racism, because when that segment was playing, it made me think about there's this show here. It's a very macabre show. It's our, I guess it's a show, but they call it an exhibit, and they actually display bodies. I think it's Plastination. I might be saying it wrong. It's Plastination. And it's basically, they've dissected bodies, but they're not completely dissected. They might have just removed the skin, and they're in different poses. So when I was driving down the street, they have a bunch of different advertisements on different taxis. And one of them, it showed like just a skeleton, and it was posed on a bike, and people actually pay to see this. It's and I was just looking up because they, you know, sell tickets for it and everything. And it just shows just the sickness of white people to actually think that this was something that is amusing. And I'm not sure, you know, the demographics of who actually goes to see this, but they did an NPR segment about, it was called The Origins of Exhibited Cadavers Questioned, and it was on All Things Considered, dated August 11th, 2006. So the interviewer this time, it seemed like he had information from their previous interview about where they're getting the bodies for these showings, because there's actually two different companies who do these different showings. And so I just felt like, you know, he almost seemed like he was acting really confused when he had the information, his very own, you know, news organization had it. But just from that article, and it just makes me think about the showing that's going on here. You know, it says it draw hundreds of thousands of people, and they have in one showing, it's called Body Works. There's two different entities doing this type of thing. They get their bodies from America and Europe, but they say they get permission. But the other showing, the Body Works, there, they don't have a show here, but the other one called Bodies, the exhibit, they say they get their cadavers from unclaimed bodies from China, all of them. So like I said, I felt like he was definitely practicing racism. The other thing was, it was in the, November 12th newspaper. It's called, the Las Vegas Review Journal. And, the title of the article is called Looking for an Edge. And they have a picture of a machine. It is basically, they profile this woman who has a gambling problem. But the sentence I just want to read, and it goes back to Stephen Paddock. It says, as a longtime gambler, Stephen Paddock inhabited a world of luxury perks and high-limit play. Recent comments from police suggest that stakes may have gotten Paddock, as he apparently endured a two-year losing streak before October 1st. Before the October 1st shooting. And I felt like that is white people right then and now trying to change history. So, okay, now they're not saying that he is, they never admit really to him being a terrorist, but now they're trying to just completely blame it on him, you know, just losing for 2 years. And that's really what made him go out and kill all these people. The very last thing I wanted to say was about the clip about Jeff Sessions. And the thing that really stuck out to me was that he said, basically, law enforcement will not lawfully hinder protest or protesters, but I feel like they make laws so they can practice racism. So that does not mean anything by what he just said, or by what he actually, by what he said in the meeting or whatever. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Appreciate that, Red. And Nevada, great point. I think a lot of the tactics that they used from COINTELPRO, I think they would point out and say, well, there's nothing technically illegal about that, you know, unseemly though it may be, but, you know, we didn't technically break any laws by snooping on some of these, you know, Negro protesters. Other folks that we've not heard from, if you had commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, sir. Thought I heard you mentioned about some questions that you wanted to ask.
I said, since Mr. William Clark is coming on the program this coming Wednesday, he was a part of the Opa-locka 3, that I suspect you could probably give a short synopsis of the Opa-locka 3 case.
Yes, sir. I can do that. Hopefully I can keep it very short. The term Opa-locka is actually a town in South Florida in the Miami-Dade County area. At one time, a lot of less confused non-white black male Miami-Dade County firefighters worked at the station. It's just abreast of a community college. And eventually over time, we started, you know, bidding out going other places. I'll just start off from where I was at the time when I first heard about it. I was further down south at my leaving from my mother's place of residence. And listening to the radio, one of the popular stations, WIOD 610, which is the news channel. And you know how they have, like, before they go into a commercial, they'll say, well, when we come back, we're going to talk about some firefighters who had a problem with the flag. Now, mind you, that this was September the 12th, the day after 9/11. The day after 9/11. And I said, that's interesting. That'd be interesting to listen to. And so I instead of going to a music channel, I you know, sat and, you know, I was a long way from getting where I was going to go. So, and it came back and it talked about three people that I know personally, you know, I mean, for years known them personally. And, when I heard about it, the next thing I did was got on the phone. And as soon as I got a chance to get on the phone, I don't even think I had a cell phone at the time. I don't know for sure. But anyway, I called William and asked him about it. And he wasn't even aware that he was on the news. He wasn't even aware that this story was on the news. Because what took place was himself and the two other firefighters, they were having a conversation at the station. It was about general things that the less confused black male firefighters, where we would talk about, including racism, along with other things we would talk about. And from that, the white firefighters, male and female, in the station, got on the phones and started calling other co-workers, white, more than likely. And the calling got all the way up to New York, all the way up to New York, and back down, you know, and probably in between. And in turn, what started happening, they started calling officials, head of departments and that sort of thing like that. It became very huge at the time. And in turn, basically, it got so hostile. At one point in time, Mr. Clark was working, attempting to work overtime at a NASCAR racetrack, which is in the Homestead area, which is further down south in Miami-Dade County. And in turn, the white firefighter refused to work with him. So they had to pay him to leave. They had actually had to pay him and ask him to leave. In turn, it became such a hostile environment, as far as I think I got the story straight, that they suspended the three with pay for almost, if not a year, it was close to a year, to where they couldn't go to work. They couldn't go to work. And in turn, they managed to get their way back on the job. Now, mind you, in between that time, as I think Chief Phillips at the time was the chief at the time, and he was you might as well say ordered to fire them, and he made the mistake on his, well, he actually, I would say it was an act of bravery on his part to refuse to fire them, because he said, and I quote, I'm not going to do that. The county manager is his boss, and I'm not going to do it because they didn't violate any policy. And so when he refused, the reason why this was known, because William and the other two guys, they can hear them talking on the other side of the door. So they heard the conversation. And in turn, the troubles came up with the chief. And in turn, he was forced to resign eventually over another issue. But am I where you want me to be at right now with the conversation?
That will certainly suffice. I'm sure Mr. Clark can fill in any extra details.
Yeah, because it may be some holes into it, because that was years ago, a long time ago. But I know with him and Terry and Jim Moore, which is the other two non-white black males, that they, it's vivid with them, because it was a very, very traumatic and nerve-wracking experience on their behalf. And so that's basically my report on that. Plus, he has a lot of other things he can share with you also. He's written an autobiography on himself, a very good book, very good book. He's part of he's created a mentoring program, and he is very busy involved into the counter-racist activities down here in South Florida. Anytime where I'm not, I'm not involved in something myself and I want to be real busy, I would find William Clark and become even more busier as far as work on participating against racism and white supremacy down here in South Florida. I mean, he is very active. That's it.
His activities will be here this coming Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be looking forward to that. If folks have commentary, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Forgive me, Gus. I'm walking to the plantation. So I'm trying to walk as fast as I can. I do have a report for later. I did some investigate and research on a story that happened here in New York. I wanted to inform the family about. First, I want to say I didn't get a chance to hear all the clips because I was underground. One of the clips that I did hear is about this black genius who unlocked his potential in prison. He turned around and gave credit to white soap operas for this happening. Now, no forms of entertainment promote white supremacy, in my opinion. Non-black made pieces of entertainment promote white supremacy like these white soap operas. Because white people get out of all kinds of situations and they have all kinds of problems they don't really have. It kind of makes them feel like they want us with rich, you know, with some money. But, you know, they're getting amnesia and buried alive. And it's just all types of crazy stuff. And for him to give his credit of unlocking his mind capacity to the soap operas as opposed to the fact that he said he read 3 books a week. Like, you did that yourself, man. You didn't need those soap operas to do that. You did it yourself. So, kudos to that dude. But I wish that he would give himself some credit for reading 3 books a week for however long he's been in jail. Anybody who reads 3 books a week is going to be mentally, you know, at a higher capacity than someone who doesn't. This one here, I spoke about it last week. TSDS, Terminal Sexual Deviant Syndrome. This story I read this week, it was in the AM New York or the Metro New York, one of those free papers they hand out. And the title was Avoiding Sex and Masturbation Will Make You a Superhero. So I read this article, and this was about gay men who stopped masturbating and picked up a hobby instead. So this one guy, she says, ever since I stopped going on dates, apps, I feel happier. I decided whenever I wanted to jerk, I would study Spanish. Alex has gone more than 95 days without masturbating, and he's nearly fluent. So how many times a day does this man think about masturbating? For him, I took Spanish for 2 years in high school, and I could count to 10. That's about all I could do. So I just thought that was very interesting, and it showed just the level of their sexual deviance, not just to other people, but to themselves. I mean, that's ridiculous. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, Gus.
Thomas in New York. Appreciate. If other folks have commentary, feel free. Let's see if I miss folks. We'll nab folks. We have folks that are spectating. I'm not even aware of black soap operas, to be truthful. I guess if you count Empire, I've never seen that, but I guess that might count. But not that that needs to be watched either. Reading is more important.
They used to have one called Generations. It was on BET for a while. It was called Generations. I don't know. When I was more confused in high school, and I would get out early because I went to Catholic school. I would watch Days of Our Lives, and I ended up getting stuck watching that. And one thing I realized is that when the summer ended and I went back to school and I came back and I started watching again, nothing ever changed. It was the same problems. I knew my line, though. Thank you.
Yep, they just go on and on and on and on. Like, I think that's part of the appeal. Like, they have the same characters, so if something happens, if there's devastation or there's a hurricane that knocks the electricity out in your area for a week or so, you can pick right back up. It'll be all the same characters. Maybe they'll have a coma, what have you, but you can pick right up, get caught up, and continue watching with all of the imaging. If we have other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, call her 3246. If you had commentary, you should be with us as well.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Imhan DC. I just wanted to say that when I spoke yesterday, and I was basically asking what's going on, that a lot of black people, a lot of black speakers are not seeing us winning as black people, us winning any time in the foreseeable future. You know, my question was, you know, why is that the situation? But, and I understand, Mr. Guts, what your response was. But I think one thing, you know, that we should keep in mind is that if you don't think that the problem can be solved, then you probably are not working to solve the problem. Even if you think that you are, if you don't think the problem can be solved, I don't know how you can be exactly solving the problem. It, you know, any team, anything that you're trying to get accomplished, I want the people who think that we can actually get this accomplished to work on the project. That's how I would be thinking. And so I would just say, you know, we should really try to figure out, well, can we actually solve this problem in this generation? Can we solve this before we die, us individually? So that's my thing. It's really, really serious. And I want to get it solved right now. If I could solve it in the next 5 minutes, I would do it. Whatever the cost would be, I would do it. We need to solve this problem now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Certainly, I think that was a message that was brought up from the documentary from 2009, Ma'afa 21, about the abortion of black babies. And that was one of the more important points of that broadcast, the very same point. When people don't think a problem can be solved, it has a huge and detrimental impact on their work ethic and even the time and energy that they will put forward to solving that problem. And racist white supremacists, I think they've done a great job convincing us that white supremacy cannot be ended. And I just do not believe that at all. This problem absolutely can be solved. The caller, I guess you dialed in on the Skype line. If you dialed in and you had commentary you wanted to share, line should be open. Proceed. Hope line, sorry. The caller who dialed in on the, it looks like you're on the Vope line with the headset, perhaps, maybe. Are you with us? Seems like you had a hand up. Oh, is this Rob in Wisconsin? Maybe I'm missing. Rob in Wisconsin, are you there? Not hearing you. If you were with us, if you were attempting to share, we're not hearing you. I'm not sure if you have your headset together or all of that, but we're not hearing you. While we're waiting to see if Rob in Wisconsin is with us. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, called other caller in Florida. If you have commentary, any of the other folks, if you have a hand up, feel free.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I was thinking about that one segment where the Jeff Sessions guy was being asked questions. I'm trying to remember what was that response he gave, I guess, where he said he didn't recall about, I guess there had been an investigation about, I guess racial identity. Did he use that term?
Let's see. I thought, I'm not sure if it was racial identity. I know she asked him, Congresswoman Bast, when she asked him about, black identity extremist report. And then she asked him about, white identity extremists, and if he could name any black organizations. I think he gave a lot of those. I don't recall. I don't remember. I'm not sure it was a lot of those non-answer type questions, or I'm ignorant. Was it one specifically that you were thinking of?
I think it was when she asked him about were there anything I think related to the sovereignty. I think that's what the name of the group she named.
Oh yeah, that it was a white group. It was a group she said that was predominantly white people that had engaged in violence against enforcement officials. Is that the one you were talking about?
Yes, that one.
Okay, I thought he said that he that was another one that he said he wasn't familiar, that he didn't know that was another. We'll have to check on that. Or did he have a more curious response?
Yeah, because it definitely seemed like he was trying to be evasive, like, or, you know, I mean, to those of us that's on the call, I think we, you know, that's one of those things to be expected. But yeah, that was a very interesting exchange, because I think, did that happen? Like, I think that was on Thursday, like kind of recently, right?
Correct. I think that was either Wednesday or Thursday of this week.
Yes, yes. And, yeah, like, it can be a lot of lessons extracted from that conversation. There was, I think, the segment where there was the student that had her, I guess, cosmetics tampered with and her belongings tampered with. I don't know who the people were that were speaking in the segment, but like, was she charged with a misdemeanor, or they tried to like mitigate the charges or something, Gus?
As I understand it right now, it's a misdemeanor. That's what she's facing. She hasn't been charged with a hate crime or anything like that. Felony, terrorist attack, misdemeanor. That's what she's facing.
Wow, that is just like amazing power right there. One other thing I wanted to mention was, it is in the area of entertainment, but there's this video game. Like, I know people are familiar with South Park. They have a new video game where apparently, like, at the beginning, like, you get to make your own character. And, like, when you get to choose your skin color, because you get to personalize the character, it says choose difficulty instead of the skin tone. And the darkest skin tone is the hardest difficulty. So, like, I found that very, very profound and racist. And they had like the sound clip of the actor saying, "Well, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with the outcome of the game, but, you know, let's just say, you know, you'll have fun playing or whatever." And apparently, it's kind of like a take on superheroes, and the head superhero name is something Captain Coon or something like that. And, you know, just a lot of, once again, to be expected, propaganda, racist propaganda. And that's all that I have for now. Thank you.
Fascinating. And white people are ignorant about racism, white supremacy. I think there should be a transcript. Generally, anything that happens in the House, like that sort of exchange, where a member of Congress is questioning someone or there's an inquiry, they generally have a transcript of everything that was said, all the questions that were asked. So that might be something that's worthy to, you know, file away. I would also say in those type of exchanges, you heard the end of it. Congresswoman Bass, she only was allotted 5 minutes. Like in those exchanges, you don't get to ask questions as long as you want. A lot of times you're confined. You only have a limited amount of time. And so I think a lot of times whites, they are very good in those exchanges. Use of time and energy. I will not use the metaphor, but they will just use words to waste time. Where they're not answering your question, they're not really saying much of anything. You might ask them a direct question, you know, did you read the report on white identity extremists? And they, well, you know, I think Dr. King was a great person, and we've got a long way to go, and we've got a lot of problems to address. And what did you say? You didn't ask. Oh, okay. Right. White identity. And they're just wasting time. So you might have 15, 20 questions that you want to ask, and they still haven't answered your first question, and they wasted about a good 2 minutes. They are excellent with that sort of thing. That's another reason if you're in those type of settings, you really want to just ask your question. There's not a whole lot of wasting of time. You're very efficient with the way that you ask the question, and you don't do a whole lot of speechifying around the question where you're talking. She was very direct with that question, and she even a lot of times stopped him once she saw that he wasn't answering. It was just hemming and hawing. Let me hop in and just go ahead and go with the next question so we can try and get as much done as we can in a limited amount of time. All very important to keep be mindful of that when you're talking with a white person in any setting. Other folks that if we've not heard from you at all, if you have a hand up, I think Rob in Wisconsin, we can try you again. Other folks, if you have a hand up, your line should be open as well. Rob in Wisconsin, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard? Okay. I was having some problems with the microphone. Greetings to Gus and the rest of the callers and the listeners on the line. Rob chiming in from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, home of Jeffrey Dahmer. Shout out to Roz for pointing out the Dahmer on Dahmer documentary. Viewed it this morning. And wow, it really puts in perspective the climate that I am now living in. And one of the worst places for Black people, as we have been considered. I would like to share a piece that out of a book I just finished. Some of the callers and listeners may be familiar with it. Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice. And it was very interesting. I called in earlier and before the program starts, about 7:50, usually Millie Fuller or some other constructive recording is playing. And tonight it was mentioned about the male and female, Black male and female fighting, and why is that, you know, such a problem. And I just like to share this piece. It says, "The war going on between the Black man and the white man is not the only war. Life is full of little wars, and you have to have a grand strategy to cope with all the hostilities. You have to have a style." And what that means to me is codification. And what I have observed in my time going through this transition period while I'm injured, just ending a 10-year relationship with offspring involved, the fight between the Black male and the Black female is draining. And it really just makes me refer back to Millie Fuller when he says, if you do not understand racism, which is white supremacy, everything that you think you understand will confuse you. And what I have been seeing, and myself at the top of the list, is just confusion. Fighting each other. I now reside within a household with blood-related relatives, and we don't act like family. You know, when I came to this house, before I came, people would just kind of walk past each other, you know, and I just started simply saying good morning and just trying to be kind. And I saw it catching on. And now it's kind of like back to where it was. And, you know, I'm really just don't really know what to do at this point in this climate. Getting closer to obtaining the degree, and in this climate, you know, I wonder what that means. And I'll end with this. Listening to the archives, Kenneth O'Reilly, second visit on the program, author, Racial Matters, and I don't remember the title of the
Nixon's Piano.
But what is most, Nixon's Piano, thank you, sir. What is most important is the college that he So I will be checking to see if that professor is still employed at that technical college. And I am just amazed at how much the city of Milwaukee is... Well, I'll just say Jeffrey Dahmer, Milwaukee, Kenneth O'Reilly in Milwaukee, Frank Jude, Milwaukee. It was a case where people, black people specifically, were getting cavity checks in the middle of the street, hand up the anus. Milwaukee. And when I travel to other states and I say, hey, you know, I'm from Milwaukee, the response would be, it's black people up there? And I'll mute my line. Thank you for listening.
Indeed. Dr. O'Reilly on the program a few times. I guess one thing I would submit, it's been my experience, the system of white supremacy, they have done such an extensive and efficient job of contaminating us with anti-blackness, generations of anti-blackness. Television has been a big part of that weapon as well, that the hostilities are not just between black males and black females. It's black females and black females. Black males and black males, and absolutely black males and black females have all sorts of hostilities, animosities, blaming one another for our problems, taking out our frustrations on one another. But I just think it's very important to make sure that, or at least I say to be specific and to say that it's not just black males and black females, because a lot of time and energy gets invested in that subject matter. The conversation you were talking about with Mr. Fuller, that was from like 30, 40 years ago, which shows how little progress we have made in improving that arrangement. And it's not going to get better until the system of white supremacy has been replaced with justice. But it's widespread. Black males don't get along with other black males. That when I just think when it gets talked about as a black male, black female issue, it ignores the greater problem that is producing all of this. And it gives one the impression that black males get along with other black males. I have not found that to be the case. Black females do not get along with other black females. I haven't found that to be the case either. That, I think, gives a better, more accurate, fuller understanding of why this problem persists. I could be in error. Do we have other folks? We miss anybody completely who's not been able to speak? Emmy, hand up. Did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Have you?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. Thank you guys for the clips. The one clip, there's two, but folks have commented on the other one with the body organ transferring and then just donating the body. That's just scary. I had the strangest feeling while I was listening to that I couldn't believe that was like a normal conversation. It felt like it shouldn't sound so normal, like people shouldn't be talking about that in such a normal tone, that, you know, they just threw the bodies away, or that people are actually selling their bodies because they can't afford a $500 to $1,000 cremation. And then I would have appreciated the interviewer asking have gone into a little bit more of what he meant by desecration. I felt that throwing the bodies away was probably the most palatable of all of the forms of desecration that these bodies had experienced. And I would have appreciated more. But I guess maybe all of that is perhaps detailed in the book, or report or whatever it is that they wrote. The second clip, which is equally as disturbing, is that a sheriff was able to stop in what seems like an entire school. If you can search 900 students, I have so many questions. Did he say he was going to do this? How many officers did he get involved? How many resources were diverted to this? Did the school know it was going to happen? How much notice were they given? Did they just barge in and do it? I mean, so many things. Because that seems like it must take some sort of organization to do. I think that the way that the story was handled was disrespectful. I don't think that there's any correlation between having maybe not any correlation, but certainly not one that warranted that much time on a particular, like on this instance, whether or not there was a dress code and one for women in the car, with the police car in the front and programming the students. Like, I mean, yeah, sure, but no. That's actually really scary that they could go into a school and search 900 students for drugs, which then begs the question, well, I mean, those kids are probably not producing the drugs. Even if they're distributing it, I'm sure you have far better resources to go after someone who's giving it to the kids to sell to one another. Like, that was your best way of trying to find drugs. So then that question is like, what was your true motive? And none of these things are really stated between that the females were having the conversation, and it just seemed beyond disrespectful and like cartoonish even. And I'm not using that, like, it seemed childlike the way that they were talking about it. And then the last thing I want to say about that is there's enough evidence to suggest that we're being programmed to think that some type of form of litigation or a lawsuit or whatever is really a remedy for some of these things. And it's just not. To say, well, now the parents have gotten together and they're filing a lawsuit, that's really not justice at all. How do you go in? Like, did they have female officers to search the female students and male officers to search the male students? And how many people, like, genitals were groped? I mean, this is, you know, what is a lawsuit really going to do? That's still up to the discretion of a judge. And then it just, to me, highlights our vulnerability and status as victims. Thank you all for listening.
Should be great motivation, great reminder, the importance of having an extensive code about your child's, your offspring's education, whatever their academic plan is going to be, homeschooling, or if you can find an independent schooling option. But that's something that should be discussed in detail before you get to the bedroom. I think that would be being a constructive and a counter-racist parent who is thinking in a logical manner for the best of their child. Because if, you know, you don't plan these things out extensively, that sort of thing is likely going to be waiting for your child, male or female. Do we have other folks who had commentary, anybody that we missed completely, or other folks who had commentary they wanted to make sure they were able to share? I think Raj should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys, to all the callers and the listeners. I'm going to keep it quite brief this week, but I wanted to first say, that clip that you played on the abuse and misuse of human body parts was just quite fascinating. And weirdly enough, I'm really glad, and greetings to you, Rob, as well, that he brought up Jeffrey Dahmer, because to me, that clip is indicative of the medical, racist medical codification of Jeffrey Dahmer-like behavior. Just from that documentary, I completely see Neely Fuller's genius when he stated that Jeffrey Dahmer is the the ultimate representative of what the system of white supremacy is working towards. You talk about sobriety, Gus. That documentary will make sobriety something that I think would become almost just something that would become just such a part of our code when you see how he used alcohol and how he used drugs to drug these victims that he used his predatory insights towards, his psychopathic predatory insights towards duping into murdering and dismembering them. When you watch his family and his father and mother discuss how they, what they thought of him, how protective they were of him, the system itself, because they went through all these different times, step by step, that he almost got caught by the police. And just because we're in a system of white supremacy, the level that of trust that is given to white people, the level of power where the average white psychopathic serial killer can literally do the things that Jeffrey Dahmer did, even with the 14-year-old boy that he drilled the holes in his skull and put acid in his brain, trying to make a zombie out of him. And the police walked him back to Jeffrey Dahmer, even though he was bloody, and allowed him to basically kill him. By the next day, they said that he actually killed the young man. His psycho obsession with having sex with cadavers. They said at one point he had a mannequin that he broke into a store and stole just so he could lay down and possess this mannequin the way that he possesses humans. I mean, this the book we're reading and that documentary so go hand in hand. It is just completely incredible how they meld together. And like I said, it was so fascinating, just the different facets of white supremacy that I was able to actually study and just pick up on, that I watched it three times and actually took notes. And I was just like, this is just one of the most powerful indictments of the way the system works that I've ever seen in that regard. So I'm really glad that Rob brought that up. Also, I forgot. There was something else, man, and it's slipping my mind. You know what? I'm going to stop there since I forgot, and when it comes back to me, hopefully I'll get a chance to chime in later. But thank you very much, and awesome program, guys. And I wanted to ask you, too, had you received any of my recent emails or no? Because I know you get swamped quite often, so you might not have gotten them, but I was just wondering if you did receive them at all.
Let me check my email. I did not check today or even yesterday, in fact. So I will have to get caught up, and I will email back once I am all caught up.
No problem. Because, I just wanted to actually talk to you about something off air. And I kind of briefly talked about it, but I wanted to kind of get into it with you just so I can give you a little more insight and just make things a little bit more clear to you. But I wanted to actually build with you about that. And, you know what? I just wanted to talk about one thing briefly. And this has to do with the whole move towards cryptocurrency that's happening quite quickly, but it's happening even more rapidly outside of the United States. Not many people in the United States really know about it. But this one kind of is relating to Zimbabwe. I don't know if anyone's been following that situation with the soft coup that's taking place and the collapse of the Zimbabwean economy. So I'm just going to read this brief paragraph or two out of here, but it's from Reuters. It's entitled, "Think Bitcoin's Getting Expensive, Try Zimbabwe." For most investors around the world, Bitcoin is a volatile, highly speculative bet. For Zimbabweans, however, the cryptocurrency seems to offer rare protection from the onset of hyperinflation and financial implosion. Some are turning to Bitcoin out of desperation as their bank deposits lose value almost by the day, while others are turning to the online currency for housekeeping, such as funding family members studying abroad. The result is startling. Bitcoin's global surge to a record high of $7,888 last week, a sevenfold increase since the start of the year, has been spectacular enough. But on Harare's Bitcoin exchange, Golix, the price hit $13,900, a 40-fold jump in the same period. Warnings abound internationally that Bitcoin may be a bubble waiting to burst, but the dire state of the Zimbabwe financial system under President Robert Mugabe is encouraging risk-taking. And I want to stop there. What's happening is Zimbabwe had transitioned to using the U.S. dollar when the Zimbabwean dollar originally collapsed years ago.
And as the U.S. dollar is now hyperinflated and collapsing, it further collapsed their economy even more, which is forcing them to turn to Bitcoin. This is exactly what's happening here. A lot more of the affluent people know about it, but the average citizen, middle class, lower class, have no concept of what Bitcoin is, or they've heard of it, but they really just don't understand anything about how it works. Whereas outside of the country, it's a growing phenomenon because different countries now are getting rid of cash in the terms of dollars and cents and only using what cryptocurrency because it's easier to tax transactions. It's all electronic, so there's never a possibility of a transaction taking place where the government's not going to be able to tax it. That is the purpose that is being propagated for, and in the United States, eventually that's going to be the case as well. So I would just implore people to learn more about it because there's ways you can use that money or that currency to transition to getting real assets, and real assets would include gold and silver. Gold and silver is the only form of money that has never lost its value throughout human history. So if you can do that, you can put yourself in a better position. So when they collapse the economy, you're not stuck standing on lines with duffel bags full of money trying to get a loaf of bread. Now, if you study the history of Venezuela, I'll be right done shortly. In Venezuela, their economy's completely collapsed at this time. And about 2 weeks ago, I dealt with an article that talked about the fact that with 1 ounce of gold, you can get 6 months worth of groceries in Venezuela. With 1 ounce of gold, you can buy a house in Venezuela. That's right now. 1 ounce of silver can also buy you months worth of food in Venezuela because their economy's collapsed. So these are the things that are happening in different places. Puerto Rico is a good example as well. That's eventually going to come here. So I just wanted to toss that out there just to give people maybe some insight into how cryptocurrency is helping those people in Zimbabwe whose dollars collapsed and they're losing value daily. They've been able to transfer some of their currency into Bitcoin and basically save the value of the money that they've accumulated over time. So I just wanted to toss that out there and give people some food for thought. Dave from Tando has a program that deals with cryptocurrency very safely for a very minimal investment. And you can get huge, huge returns in regards to accumulating Bitcoin, which is projected to hit 10 grand per Bitcoin by the end of this year and as high as 50 grand per Bitcoin by next year. And down the road, projected to hit $500,000 per Bitcoin. So I just wanted to toss that out there. And again, it doesn't mean that they're not going to mess with this currency. There's not enough people using that platform for them to do anything really horrific with it. But it's something you can use to leverage and put yourself ahead of what's coming and then eventually obtain real assets that can really save you and your family and those you care about when this dollar is no longer a viable means of financial exchange. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Roz, I will update once I have checked my email and what have. We have about 30 minutes. So if other folks have comments, questions, commentary they want to make sure they share before we wrap things up, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you have commentary. Did we miss anyone? Anyone that had a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Grant. Okay. I think we got everybody. Any of the other folks who had a hand up, did they have additional commentary they wanted to share?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Red in Nevada again. I just wanted to quickly say just about Roz's comment. I was downtown in Las Vegas today, and it was weird because I saw a casino that was advertising that they now accept Bitcoin. I don't know anything about it, but I just thought that was odd. That's all I wanted to add. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Rob in Wisconsin, if you could speak up a little bit, we can hear you. Just if you could give us a bit more volume, that would be
helpful. Is that better?
Slightly.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I was in greater confinement and soap operas during the beginning of my time in greater confinement was prevalent. And I started to recognize it as feminine. And that's what made me stop watching the stories, soap operas. And as the clip was playing out, it took me back to that time. And I'm still processing it. That's why I didn't speak on it the first time around. But while he was talking about that, I really just took me back to Mr. Nellie Fuller again when he talks about the effeminization of Black men, Black males specifically. And it really sounded, it didn't sound right to me. And when I was there, it didn't, you know, after a while, it didn't feel right. You know, a bunch of men, and he, in the clip, he even referenced to, you know, quote unquote killers, a guy named Baby Shaq and, you know, whatever the other people's name was, but all of these quote unquote men sitting around watching the soap operas. And the TV, like you say, is very powerful. And as my time progressed in greater confinement, I only use the TV as a window to the world. Excuse me, that's a metaphor. I only use the TV for news purposes, constructive information. And it is very easy to get into a routine where you are watching television for hours on end. Thank you.
I have talked to Black people who've been in greater confinement, and they said that they felt that the television was being used in just that manner. They said that they felt that television in prison was integral to maintaining control over the inmates, and that if they did not have TV, that they felt like the warden, the guards, they would have to work substantially harder to keep control of things. That television works great for those, however long it's on while you're there. It works great capturing folks' attention, and you don't have to worry about what folks are doing. They are viewing. Do we have other folks who had commentary they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so the organ clip, that was the other clip that I remember hearing. You know, when they had the storms in Houston, and I would go to clean the OR, because that's generally, at that time, that was what they had me doing every night. I would notice that the techs were gone. So when they came back a couple weeks later, I asked, you know, wait, you guys were on vacation? They said, no, they sent us down to Houston. They were stationed in Galveston. I said, oh, okay. So they pretty much let me know that they probably had, I hate to use the metaphor, but all hands on deck for organ transplanters down there to capitalize off of that destruction. I want to say peace to Rob from Wisconsin. I haven't heard from him in a while. If you have my number still, please reach out to me, brother, because I switched phones and I don't have yours. I wanted to talk about a report about something that happened on NYSHA with NYSHA. I'm not sure if you're familiar with NYSHA, Gus, but NYSHA, NYCHA, New York City Housing Authority. And before I get into the report, I just wanted to give some details, some context to the whole thing, to give us a little perspective. In the Bronx, you have 89 housing developments, 44,000 apartments, 99 in Brooklyn with 58,000 apartments, 97 in Manhattan, 52,000,
apartments, 21 in Queens with 15,000, 10 in Staten Island with 5,000. They have 138 apartments that they control within 10 buildings that are through the FHA. 41 senior developments with 9,600 apartments, 15 seniors mixed buildings where they have regular people too. 7,000 retrofitted apartments for people with disabilities. 86,000 apartments that they rent out for Section 8 units in private houses and buildings that they're responsible for. And this is all NYSHA. 1,500 apartments for portability vouchers. 4,300 apartments with HUD vouchers. And a total of 590,000 people live in public housing in New York and in Section 8 housing. So that's more people than Atlanta, more people than Sacramento. The same amount of people as Milwaukee, where Rob is, live in public housing or in Section 8 in New York. So this week, the report just came out. NYSHA, they just allowed two white racists to resign, the two top officials, because they were found for years, maybe decades, to lie and say that they removed the lead paint from these developments, and they didn't. The lead poisoning, as we know, is environmental racism. And I also call this chemical warfare used against blacks, just like drugs were. And, I mean, Freddie Gray's case, I think that was pretty much documented how terrible lead poisoning is. So they receive more than $2 billion every year from Washington to deal with removing the lead paint from these buildings. However, they haven't done it in years, like I said, maybe decades. Just think of all the children now who probably are lead poisoned, that out of those 590,000 residents, I'm sure quite a bit are children. The black chair lady of NYSHA, she was responsible for signing these documents and receiving the money. She found out that they weren't doing their job, and she went and told authorities, which led to these guys to resign, who I think they should be put in prison. So this is generations of blacks have to suffer from lead poisoning that is supposed to have been cleared up years ago, and it's in every city. It's not as bad as Flint where they're drinking the lead, but I mean, this is terrible. And just think of how many kids suffer from ADHD or ADD. I wonder if this lead poisoning could have been what is the after effect that they call ADHD or ADD. I mean, we don't know. But they're not adding that into the equation because as far as the federal government knows, they pay money. And this stuff is supposed to be cleared out of these places. So there is no lead poisoning, even though it is. So I would like to know if they're testing people, testing these areas for lead poisoning. And the last little thing I wanted to say, Gus, I was watching on the YouTube channel here in New York, the guy Sarnetta. And I thought it was very interesting. It was like watching an episode of The Cows. They've been moved off of 125th Street where they stood in front of a vacant building would do the filming. But finally, someone decided to renovate that building and open up a business. So they put scaffolds out and things. So they've been moved out of their normal spot. So he goes to Times Square and he stops a white couple and he asks them to speak. And the white woman stays on cold, but the white man, he slips up and he starts answering questions. So when the questions start to talk about race, he says, "Oh man, I've been drinking tonight. So you know, if I say something wrong, please forgive me." So I said, "Oh, he's gonna be honest." So he started answering questions honestly, and he started practicing deception too. And they were putting him out on the deception as he goes lower. Well, it's the older generation, and they're like, no, you know, we still have this stuff happening with the younger generation. Oh well, it's just some ignorant people." You know, and he starts talking, and then you saw the Voltron effect. He even admits to using nigger, and you saw the Voltron effect where this white male who wasn't working with them initially when they ask him to speak, he comes out of nowhere with a cell phone and says, hey, your mother's on the phone. Hey, she wants to speak to you now. And he, like, puts the phone to his ear, and he, you know, drags the guy away. That was his way to get rid of him. So I said, look at that, the Voltron effect. I thought it was hilarious. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Oh, that's funny. That is hilarious. And again, you cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and perform that sort of quote unquote rescue if you see one of your fellow white brethren in trouble with the niggers and you want to get them out of that situation. With the New York Housing Authority, I published a post today that was talking about how de Blasio knew about this malfeasance. The great recently reelected Mayor Bill de Blasio, insert cowbell as well on that one, that he knew. It seems like, I agree, this seems like a pretty enormous criminal offense, not just, you know, oh man, y'all have contaminated niggers for generations. Like, it would seem like a whole lot of people should be extremely upset. Where did the money go that you, I mean, I don't know how many, you know, what the exact dollar figure for all of those years that they were carrying out this crime. But I mean, wow, like, it, where's the repayment of the funds and criminal charges, investigation, like major, that the folks in Congress, they should get rolling on that one too. If they took federal dollars for that, like, hey, where, that's tax dollars that they, you know, are doing whoever knows what with. In addition to that is a gargantuan act of white supremacy racism. And I'm pretty sure New York is not the only location where that sort of thing happened, where whites just said, oh yeah, we got, you know, all the lead. I think the one of the sound clips that we started with this week, they were talking about environmental racism in Houston after the hurricanes, where the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, they made a report and said, oh yeah, it's safe, everything's good, you know, go ahead, you can return, no problem. And then, oh my Lord, we had one of the biggest gas spills in the history of the continental U.S. And, you know, inhaling that can cause cancer and damage organs and all this other stuff, where the people said they could smell it. That I'm very sure that that sort of thing happens all over the world, not just in the U.S., where whites will say that they have removed or made the area safe. And then you find out 15, 20 years later that that's not the case at all, after all the damage has already taken effect. And I think exactly as Thomas in New York said, I think we should just take the position that these are intentional, deliberate acts of racism, white supremacy, chemical, biological warfare specifically. And I posted the article on from the New York Daily News saying that Mayor Bill de Blasio knew about all this. I posted that, and I also posted the report about the body parts industry, and it's broken up into segments. It's like five or six different reports. I think one of the last reports talks about the military conducting experiments on these body parts. And they even, during the exchange, they were saying that the military, they would get these body parts so they could do testing on explosives to see how the bombs impact the bodies, and designing safety gear and that sort of thing. It was, might be worth the read. Do we have other folks who had commentary they wanted to get in?
I have a report, Gus, if nobody else had anything.
Let's hear it.
Okay. BBC brought out a documentary on Milwaukee called The Dark States. And it was controversial because they went to a couple of homicide sites, and they actually show the black males on the ground bleeding, injured, dead. And one part in particular stood out to me in the documentary. I found the documentary reading is more important than watching television. There was a link to the documentary in a news article that I was reading. And I'm watching it, and they are showing gun owners, and they went to this one household, and it was a female that was in possession of the firearms to protect her home. And the interesting thing to me was, and I go back to Mr. Neely Fuller, and part just rung in my mind. The gay rights movement is changing everything and talking about how the roles of gender is being reversed. Now, in this household where the female was handling most of the firearms, there was a male present. And I didn't notice him at first because it was so much focused on the female. And, you know, she was just, you know, talking about how she protects her home. And what really stood out to me is she had an offspring, and they talk about how she hit him upside the head with a skillet. And he, the offspring, says that, you know, I kind of needed that, you know, to keep me in line. I have my own vehicle and I'm working. And, you know, it was really hard for me to watch, coming from a household where domestic violence started young. My mother striking me as a form of discipline, and I didn't recognize it as domestic violence at first, because it seems like that is just normal behavior in the community which I come from. And I'm starting to recognize it as not normal behavior. And the question that I have is, and it's not, I'm not looking for an answer for it, just maybe just putting it out there, but what gives the a human being the right to strike another human being? And thank you.
Appreciate you for sharing, Rob, in Wisconsin. That documentary is available online if people are interested in checking it out. I think it's titled Dark States, Murder in Milwaukee, from the BBC, if you all want to check it out. But my only response, I think in the system of white supremacy encourages so much violence. I think we've been talking about the latest documentary on Jeffrey Dahmer. It's just violence all the time gets encouraged, and particularly as it relates to black people. That's really about the only way that you are supposed to relate to a black person, is some form of violence, verbal violence, physical violence. That's, you know, what's to be expected under the system of racism, white supremacy. And I think a lot of us can attest that's what we have experienced, a lot of us, for the bulk of the time that we've been on the planet, violence. Do we have any other folks? We have about 10 minutes before we wrap things up. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
May I be heard?
Yes. Oh, go ahead. I'll go after you.
I'm sorry. I'll make this really quick. I also in the, this is Brett again, also in the newspaper, it made me think about the book study, and how in the book study it was spoken about how the author was the offer for this current book study, how he was kind of he might have been practicing racism, just speaking about like coddling the brain of John Wayne Gacy. And so in the newspaper, just tying it into the book study, the article, it says it's titled Indonesian Museum Hitler Defended as Selfie Hotspot. And they have this picture of a life-size mannequin of Hitler right outside of Auschwitz, and people go and they take pictures with it, and it's like a really, it's supposed to be, and they even in the article it says it's a heroically posed Hitler, and but later on they say, oh well, he did kill people, he killed over 1 million people, but he was still kind of like a posed as a hero, and people actually smile and take pictures with it, and there's been no complaints. So this is yet again, you know, I'm not sure if this is white people or not, because it is in Indonesia, but, you know, just, I don't know, holding up, okay, making heroes out of murderers and such. Thank you.
That's where Obama spent some of his formative years growing up. If folks remember our book club, they don't have a statue of him for people to come and take selfies and do a little tourist pose. They got to pick a mass merc. Roz, thank you for your patience. Proceed.
No problem. I just wanted to touch on something that I came across, actually. I wanted to give a shout to Thomas in New York for bringing this up. There's this new trend that white people, because I just recently saw an article on the white male doing this as well. So white people are injecting themselves with synthetic melanin in order to turn themselves black. And the article was actually entitled The Dangers White Women Are Going Through to Turn Themselves Black. It's on BET.com, and they're discussing the dangers of this. So I'm just going to read a brief section from it. So it says, according to all three dermatologists we spoke to, they would discourage anyone and everyone from receiving such injections. This is both due to the lack of FDA regulation, which makes it impossible to know what's really in the solution, and the lack of research on the drug and its long-term health effects. Commonly referred to as the Barbie drug, melanotan, aka synthetic melanin, can cause nausea, vomiting, flushing, stomach cramps, decrease appetite, fatigue, and allergic reactions, and can even accelerate the onset of skin cancers. Turns out, putting a synthetic foreign agent into your bloodstream is not good for you. Who would have thunk? Melanotan comes in two forms, melanotan 1 and melanotan 2. The former has some FDA-approved uses for very specific and somewhat rare ailments. The latter is not FDA-approved and is being sold online, promising benefits such as sunless tanning, though due to the lack of regulation, there's no way to know what you're getting. This is the very reason why doctors are warning against using it, citing adverse reactions and visibly permanent skin damage. Excuse me. It says, when a medication is unregulated, we can't be confident in its purity, and that makes accurate dosing impossible. There can even be problems with contamination and sterility. That's Dr. Kenneth Howe at Wexler Dermatology said, a further complication is the fact that melanotan is sold in various forms, nasal sprays, freeze-dried powders, which then have to be mixed with bacteriostatic water before being injected. One dermatologist, Dr. Alan Parts, founder of Derm Warehouse, categorized melanotan injections as, quote, not something we'd ever perform on patients in our office. I would say that's because it is an unregulated drug and that you can buy online and do it yourself. It's likely not safe, and you should stay away from it, he said, unquote. What I found about it is that the kind of body warping skin transformations, like they get like weird bumps and lesions, and it's just, from what I understand, these white people, and I air quotes around the word people, they are willing to do anything to look like us. Jeffrey Dahmer proves they will even eat us and stash us away for later consumption. I mean, everything about what white people do is about trying to get what's missing. That's what really makes Dr. Marimbani's work so essentially important as far as understanding the white psychopathology. And thank you. Thanks again. But yeah, melanotan 1, melanotan 2, the new white way of trying to be black again. I'll mute my line.
Wish we had Dr. Welsing around to get her thoughts and analysis on that loss. But she gave us a lot while she was, for the decades that she was here, she gave us a lot. We have any other folks who had commentary that wanted to make sure they get in before we conclude the...
I would love to know what type of tan Donald Trump gets, man. That has to be a Crayola tan, because that is an orange. Only comes in a box of Crayola crayons. I did want to say I have a conspiracy theory. You know, I've noticed that white women have seemed to use black struggle as their come up from the feminist movement, which kind of came right behind the Black Power movement, et cetera. Now, since they've softened these rules to get Bill Cosby, as far as terms of limitation on rape and on sexual misconduct allegations, it seems like white women are taking advantage of this right now. Everyone's been touched or raped, or, you know, they went in the back room somewhere. And I wonder if they're setting them up to take over the system. To have a white matriarchal system replace this white patriarchal system, because they're in a very good position right now to do so. And I just want to know your thoughts on that, and I'll mute my line.
Well, some of us, I think, have already concluded that we, the system of white supremacy, is a matriarchy, in spite of the gripes and allegations of patriarchy and its various forms. And certainly you do have a lot of white men abusing and terrorizing white women, and that has gone on in a variety of forms for centuries, if not longer. But it'll be interesting. This could just be a reordering of how things are going to operate. I think white women and white men, I think they squabble and bicker about power on the plantation. I think they've been doing that for centuries, for a long time. So this just could be a reordering of the power structure. They might want a little more at this particular point in time. But yeah, I think, at least in my view, white women have been in charge of how things are operating all the while. This is, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing for tomorrow, for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism, folks that are in different parts of the globe, what they think about this, because this has been not just happening in the States. This is beyond, where folks over in England, some of the same allegations, and some of the folks that have been accused here, I think like Harvey Weinstein, they're looking at his activities worldwide. So I'm very interested to see if this, what sort of changes folks over there are seeing. Is this changing laws or rules in the workplace that they're in, to get answers? Did any other folks have a response to Thomas in New York's question?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Actually, Thomas, I believe we discussed this past Wednesday on the show that we did. And I said to him similar thing. I said, yeah, white women are the origin of this system. And as much as they propagate the white male as the face of white supremacy, they're the ones that are really in total control of the way that white men function and act in the system, in my opinion. And I said, well, I think what it is that they have taken a behind the scenes approach to their domination of white supremacy. And it is possible that with this, this ability to segue through this explosion of sexual terrorism that's coming out now, as if it's something new, they can actually use this as as an ability to catapult themselves as the face of white the face of white supremacy in place of the white male. So it's a way of them coming out from behind the scenes and putting themselves, oh, that's a metaphor, coming out from their place of hidden control to a place of overt overt control, where you can just see them as the overt oppressors that they are, versus the males that they've been propagating throughout the history of white supremacy. That's my opinion. And like you said, what you said, I think also makes logical sense. It could definitely just be a reordering, or it could just be the coming out of the white woman from behind the scenes as the face of white supremacy in the way the white male used to be. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say I always definitely enjoy Thomas from New York and Roz's commentary, but I truly agree, because I can, you know, just my commentary back from, you know, when I worked at my previous job, and even, you know, just here, especially within Las Vegas, with how much sexuality is blatantly everywhere. I feel like it's, and I'm not just here, but, you know, of course, everywhere. I feel like, yes, I definitely feel like white women, they are, you know, trying to not only be the victims of white supremacy, but also, you know, be the ones who are in control of it. Thank you.
I have a quick response.
Yes, sir, Rob in Wisconsin. If you could give us a little bit more volume.
Sorry. Okay, yes. Quick response. Thank Roz and Thomas for the commentary. I didn't put it together. My mind didn't formulate it the way that they did, but it made me ask a question. With everybody coming out with these sexual allegations, you know, people being sexually mistreated and everything, I just asked the question, what is going on? Thank you.
One thing I would insert, because I even The clip with Mumia Abu-Jamal and the second clip that I played where he was talking about the sexual abuse, that was their audio was not good. And when I listened to it, I thought it might be loud enough to play, but it was very, very low. But that was just the way. I mean, he's in greater confinement, so, you know, it's not like they have world-class studio recording that they're working with. But he, in the clip, was saying women are stepping forward with these allegations. Women are making these allegations. Women are making these allegations. There have been a lot of that, but I think a lot of these allegations have been males. I think it was a whole, I think it was exclusively males who were accusing Kevin Spacey, unless I'm in error. Terry Crews, the black male actor who said that he was molested by another male. I think it's been quite a few males, even a white male accused Mariah Carey of being racist and sexually harassing him. It's been quite a few males that have made allegations in all this as well. Just being correct about the data, but that is something to think about in terms of what is all of this and how is this going to change, alter the way that the system has been operating. And certainly I think the primary beneficiary of this absolutely will be white women. I cannot see if former First Lady Michelle Obama, if she were to come out, me too. You know, I had an experience of abuse with a white, you know, male person said such and such. I have a difficult time thinking that they would be very sympathetic to a Michelle Obama if it was a black female or even a black male that came out and said, oh, yeah, I was, you know, victimized in this sort of way, too. I just very difficult time seeing how that would work. I don't recall when Daniel Holtzclaw was on trial. I don't recall a tremendous outpouring of sympathy for the black females in Oklahoma City who were his victims. I don't remember that, but maybe I wasn't reading the correct publications. Anywho, we will be here tomorrow for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Tune in, and certainly I will be asking to get input on this from other folks around the world, because this is a global phenomenon currently. We'll also be here on Wednesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Former Miami firefighter William Clark, black male, will be here to get his experience on the racism he experienced in the department when he was a firefighter and his thoughts on the current allegations and problems with white supremacy in the Miami Fire Department. Wednesday evening, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thanks for all the folks for participating, sharing their views. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. If I can get my suggestion out again, sobriety would be best. I think Roz mentioned that earlier in the broadcast. There are just a myriad of different weapons aimed at black people, particularly non-white people in total. I think it would behoove us to be thinking clearly at all times so that we can be mindful of what's happening around us. If we need to make quick decisions to keep ourselves safe or anybody, you know, that we care about might be responsible for, to keep them safe as well. There's a lot of evidence that race soldiers, they have done a tremendous job exploiting opportunities where we might be intoxicated, getting us intoxicated so that they can further abuse and terrorize us. I think Dr. Welsing, her name was mentioned. I think she, Dr. Marimba Ani, Mr. Fuller, Dr. Kanban, I think they would all, Rosa Parks included, strongly encourage, recommend us taking care of our brain computer, being sober so that we can solve the problem. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. If you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, certainly be sober, but also buckle up. We want to do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.